You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
Do you know why you'll never be as good as The Rock?
Because I'm not that talented.
Who's the man? Yeah, who's the people's champ? Yeah, who's always going to own John Cena? Yeah, give me some again. Yabba dabba!
Welcome to The Sound Off. It is episode 151 proof. The Bacardi edition of the podcast here this week. It is Sunday, March 20th, 2011. I am the Solomonster here with you. March 20th means that it's the 17-year anniversary this month to the day, in fact, of WrestleMania 10 from Madison Square Garden. Of course, the classic ladder match between Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon, and the brother versus brother gem between Bret and Owen Hart 17 years ago today at MSG. God, that makes me feel old. We have got an absolute shit ton of stuff to get to here this week. No joke, this has got to be the biggest rundown I've ever had for a podcast here. Just a list of topics that just goes on and on and on. And just this weekend alone, a couple of different things happen here. And I have to start off, unfortunately, with some sad news. Sir Oliver Humperdinck, who was one of the most famous managers in the history of professional wrestling, real name John Sutton, passed away overnight at the age of 62. Complications from pneumonia while battling bladder cancer is unfortunately cited as the culprit. His tumor was way too big to operate on, and there have been rumors in the last couple of weeks that he had decided to forego additional chemotherapy for hospice care, which was pretty much a signal that the end was near. Now, for those of you that don't know what hospice care is exactly, essentially it is care that you are admitted into to ensure that your final days here on this earth are as comfortable and peaceful as possible. It's basically a place that people will often go to just serve out the remainder of their days as peacefully as possible, because there is no hope, or they just simply decide that, you know, whatever the solution is to their problem, they don't want to go through with it. And in this case, it would have meant some pretty heavy doses of chemotherapy for a man who, quite frankly, was not in the best of physical conditions. You know, he was not an old man at the age of 62. That's not old by any means, but he's been through a lot health-wise in recent years, and when he contracted the pneumonia, that just made the problems that much worse. And unfortunately, the news came this morning. Several people on Twitter, including Paul Bearer, who's been good friends with him for many years, Jim Ross as well, has been good friends with him, and they pretty much confirmed that he did die early this morning. Basically, Humperdinck became a staple in the Florida territory in the 1970s, and followed that up with a stint in Jim Crockett Promotions in the Mid-Atlantic region in the early 80s, where he managed people like Greg Valentine and the One Man Gang, among others. He worked in the WWF, which is what I remember him for. I grew up, by and large, a WWF fan here in the Northeast, and I vividly remember him winning the services of one of the hottest free agents to enter the World Wrestling Federation at the time, which, of course, was Bam Bam Bigelow. This would have been back around 87. And I remember Bam Bam at the time was being courted by all of the managers in the WWF. And each week there would be a promo that each one would cut, whether it was the Slickster or Bobby Heenan or Jimmy Hart. And one by one, they were eliminated until Humperdinck was introduced as his bodyguard. And he was also in Bigelow's corner at WrestleMania 4, which turned out to be Humperdinck's only Mania show that he ever appeared on. And I watched WrestleMania 4 recently. I think I did a quick review of it on the show last week, recently aired on WWE Classics On Demand. And Bam Bam was eliminated in the first round in what was basically just a 3-minute match in the tournament. Ironically, he was beaten by One Man Gang after Bam Bam got counted out. Now, I believe Bigelow had a knee injury at the time, which is why the match had to be kept so short, although that was the story of a lot of matches at WrestleMania 4. But nonetheless, that's what Humperdinck is most known for in his brief time in the WWF. And from there, I believe he did work in WCW as well. And, you know, that was pretty much, I think, the last organization of a national kind that he appeared for before he kind of slinked off and did other things. And He was a prominent member of the Cauliflower Alley Club and appeared at many of the banquets and functions, including, I think, either the most recent one or the one before that, because Jim Ross had remarked that he was happy he was able to meet with Humperdinck fairly recently, knowing that he was not in the best shape in the world. So, sad situation whenever something like that happens, and it was not completely unexpected given his condition over the last several weeks, but just had to mention that. That was kind of a bummer to find out this morning when I woke up. A lot of other things happening this weekend as well. On a more positive note, Ring of Honor had a show here at the Manhattan Center in New York City yesterday afternoon, and in somewhat of a shocker that was kept apparently a pretty good secret because not too many people knew about it, Eddie Edwards, one half of the American Wolves tandem, along with Davey Richards, defeated Roderick Strong to win the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight title. And I had people on Facebook and such asking me what I thought about this, and basically I say good for him. You know, Eddie is a hard worker who deserves a shot, I think, as much as anyone else, and I hope he makes the most of it. I would anticipate that he will probably have some length to his reign. I guess we'll find out. I believe after the match, his partner Davey Richards came out to tease some sort of confrontation, and then Davey kind of smiled and hugged him. I don't know if this is setting up an eventual turn where Davey will turn on his partner and cost him the championship, or perhaps it will lead to, and this actually wouldn't surprise me at all, and would probably result in some pretty fucking fantastic matches if they wanted to do a Davey Richards turn, but not to cost Eddie Edwards the title, but rather to lead to an American Wolves feud for the world championship. I think that would be a hell of a feud, quite frankly, in ROH. So that was the big news coming out of the ROH show yesterday at the Manhattan Center. Again, lots of things happening yesterday here in what we call the tri-state area, which, of course, for the benefit of those of you who don't know what that is, it's basically just the way that people here refer to the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut region here in the States. They call it the tri-state area. And Connecticut, I guess, was the state that was left out because everything seemed to be going on in New York or New Jersey. You had the ROH show at the Manhattan Center in the afternoon. You had the WWE literally right next door in Midtown Manhattan at Madison Square Garden for a house show. A house show, by the way, where 2011 Hall of Fame inductee Sonny made a special appearance as a guest referee. Got a pretty nice reaction from the crowd, from what I understand. And then in nearby Newark, New Jersey, you had UFC 128, which aired on pay-per-view at the Prudential Center. Big story there, speaking of title changes, not only did Eddie Edwards win the ROH title in Manhattan, but in Jersey at the UFC pay-per-view, Johnny Bones Jones captured the UFC Light Heavyweight Championship from Mauricio Shogun Hua to become the youngest champion of any kind in UFC history. Mind you, this is with only 3 years of real MMA training. Jones is a fantastic wrestler. He's been wrestling, I believe, since at least college, probably earlier than that. But really, he's only had about 3 years or so of MMA training. And almost overnight, it seems, he has become certainly one of, if not the biggest star, not only in UFC, but because UFC is the dominant organization, that makes him one of the biggest stars in the world. And what's kind of funny about this is earlier in the day yesterday, and I'm sure many of you have already heard about this story, so I'll just summarize it here, but Bones Jones chased down a mugger in a park in New Jersey and subdued him until police arrived. Basically, a woman was, I'm not sure if she was attacked, but she was mugged and ran off. And Jones was there with his coach, I believe it was Greg Jackson, of the Team Jackson camp where he trains. And I believe Jackson and perhaps another person went to run after the perpetrator. And John Jones decided he was going to run after the person as well. And apparently in doing so, he passed even Greg Jackson and the other person. That's how fast he was running. Of course, I'm sure Jackson was, his heart must have just leapt up into his throat when he saw this, because, you know, here's John Jones, one of the biggest stars in MMA. In a couple of hours, he's fighting on pay-per-view in a championship match, and all he needs to do here in running after this guy is just tear a knee out or something. Thankfully, that did not happen. He caught up to the guy, like I said, subdued him, and you couldn't script a better story than that. And then a couple of hours later, he goes ahead and just absolutely dominates Shogun Hua. It was just a complete one-sided ass-whooping to decidedly become the new champion, which For those of you who are UFC fans, sets up a very interesting matchup now, because Rashad Evans, who was next in line for a shot at the championship and is a very good friend of John Jones and part of the Greg Jackson camp, suffered what I believe was a knee injury a short time ago, and John Jones essentially replaced Rashad Evans in this championship fight with the understanding that should John Jones win the title, he would then defend the championship against Rashad Evans, because when Evans gets better, it's only fair that he gets the title shot that he did not get because he was hurt. And that created a bit of a controversy because, you know, I guess Greg Jackson, and perhaps there's other camps like this as well, does not want two of his fighters fighting each other. That's just an absolute no-no. And apparently it's going to happen anyway. And Rashad Evans, I guess, if he hasn't already, will leave the Jackson camp, so there is no so-called conflict of interest. But, you know, John Jones not surprisingly won the title. He will defend the championship against Rashad Evans, probably sometime later in the year. I don't think it's going to happen in the next couple of months. And it's kind of funny because I saw the fight last night, which, again, was just a complete annihilation. And after the fight, you know, Bones Jones was happy and all that, and then they did the post-fight interviews, and he you know, did an interview with Joe Rogan, who was the color guy for UFC, and then he goes into the Octagon, and he does the post-fight interviews, and it was almost pro-wrestling-esque the way they set this up. After they did the post-fight interviews with the winner and the loser, all of a sudden, there's Rashad Evans, dressed to the nines in his suit, inside the cage, and they decide to bring Evans and John Jones together in the middle of the Octagon, and they're going to interview them both. And, of course, Joe Rogan is doing his very best to stir the shit up between these two guys. And you could just tell Rashad Evans basically said, yeah, you know, I'm gonna fight him for the title. And John Jones looked like his dog got shot, ran over, and set on fire. I mean, he did not look happy at all. Although he accepted his fate and said, yeah, you know, I'm going to do what I got to do. I'm going to defend the championship against Rashad if that's what I need to do. But clearly he is not happy about this. He does not want to fight his friend. Apparently his friend doesn't give a shit. He just wants the championship. So not the best way to set up a fight. Somebody, you know, I think somebody had said, you know, send him to Brock Lesnar training school. Or, you know, you could probably say the same thing about Frank Mir. Those are two guys that know how to promote and hype a fight. And hyping a fight as one that, well, I'm only taking it because I have to, and I really don't want to fight my friend. Probably not the best way to promote a fight, but still, it was a little uncomfortable seeing the two of them in the cage like that. But I'm sure in a couple of months, when UFC promotes it on pay-per-view, it's going to do unbelievable business. And at the end of the day, that's really all that matters. So that sets up an interesting fight. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on this because I got a lot of other shit to get to here, but I have to say this. And I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm hoping a lot of people listening to this agree with me. In the post-fight interviews, Joe Rogan interviewed John Jones, and then he interviewed Shogun Hua, the former champion and loser of the fight last night. Now, Shogun is a Brazilian fighter. There's many, many very talented Brazilian fighters in the UFC, and fighters from other countries as well, who either don't speak very good English or don't speak any English at all, and in some cases, they just flat out refuse to even learn English. So, Joe Rogan is interviewing him, and of course, when you have a fighter who can't speak the language, they have to communicate through their translator. And it's a whole process, because Joe Rogan asks a question, he's basically asking the question to the interpreter then has to explain it to the fighter, then the fighter speaks in his own language to the interpreter, and the interpreter has to then convert that into English for Joe Rogan and the rest of the audience. And it's just... it takes forever. It just kills the mood. The fans start booing in some cases. Look, here's the deal. I have no problem if a fighter tries to learn the language and just isn't good at English, you know? He tries, he learns maybe a little bit, but he's not necessarily fluent in the English language. No problem. At least he's trying. What I have a problem with, and I'm not sure if Shogun falls into this camp, but I know there are fighters who simply don't want to learn English or they don't put the maximum effort into it. This is UFC, the biggest MMA organization, not only in this country, but now in the entire world. Okay, Pride is not around anymore. Strikeforce was eaten up by UFC, although they weren't anything close to UFC anyway. But UFC is, you know, to use an analogy, the WWE of its genre, only bigger at this point in some way. And in some ways, WWE is bigger because they have so many different revenue streams and different divisions. You know, UFC doesn't have a movie division, but that's the analogy. UFC is to their world what WWE is to their world. And this would be the equivalent of WWE, you know, signing an entertainer, to a contract, and perhaps this person comes from somewhere in Europe, doesn't speak very good English, and they just put him on TV without him even knowing the language. That would never happen. Until now with Sin Cara. But I was going to use him as an example, actually. You know, here's an example of somebody, coming into the WWE, likely a little bit after WrestleMania. He's going to be making his debut. They've made a very big deal out of his signing. He comes from Mexico and apparently knows very little, if any, English at all. And the plan was to send him down to developmental, make sure he learns the language, and then bring him up to TV. And, you know, Vince McMahon obviously decided that we made a very large investment in this very small person. We're paying him a lot of money. We want to make a return on this investment ASAP. And we need to establish another, popular Mexican star, because who knows how long Rey Mysterio is going to be around for. Hence the reason that the man formerly known as Místico will be making his television debut sometime within the next month or so, even though he doesn't know any English. From what I understand, he will be learning on the road. I don't know who's going to teach him. So it's not as though he is not going to make any attempt to learn the language, because one thing that WWE and UFC have in common, people sell matches and fights with their mouth, not even their fists. Especially not in wrestling. Because in wrestling, everyone knows it's staged. You sell a fight or you sell a storyline or an angle on promos. That's just the way it is, for better or worse. And if you can't speak the language, it really, really, really hinders things as far as that goes. And being able to sell a fight and do your job to the best of your ability. You know, in wrestling, like I said before, you don't have to be fluent or perfect at it. I mean, look at a guy like Vladimir Kozlov. Or Scott Steiner, for example. Neither one of those guys can speak English very well, but they try. And people, for the most part, I think, kind of, sort of understand what they're saying. I just was watching this interview, and I don't know, it's not his fault, but I see a lot of fighters when I watch these UFC shows and other, you know, Bellator or other forms of MMA. Not that I watch it all the time, but when I do, you know, they're communicating with their translator. I'm just like, oh, for fuck's sake, just learn the goddamn language. This is your job. You know, you work for a company that is based here in this country, and I know you do big business overseas, although I guess, you know, WWE does more business overseas probably than UFC does. UFC, their bread and butter, I think, still comes from this country. This is an English-speaking country, and I'm not saying that, speak English or get out or anything like that, but what I'm saying is it's part of your job to go on television as a performer, as an entertainer, and understand the language, and at least try to speak the language and communicate in that language. And, you know, for the people who don't even make any attempt to do that, and then they do these interviews and they have, you know, it's so stupid. Learn the language. It's part of your job. All right. Enough about that. Let's talk about what I'm sure you all want to hear about. TNA Victory Road. The only regret I have is that I recorded the sound off last weekend, a little before the pay-per-view, and I had to wait an entire week to give my thoughts on this, but that's just the way it is. When you have a real job and you don't have time to record a podcast during the week, you bottle your thoughts and emotions up inside and you just wait until it just explodes out into the microphone this weekend. And I promised myself, yeah, I'm not going to get angry about this. I think I calmed down over the last couple of days. We all know TNA is a stupid organization run by stupid people. This is not a shock. But, you know, I'm going over my notes again as far as what happened last week, and it makes me angry all over again. Now, Victory Road was a pay-per-view that, I will admit, a friend of mine sent me a link to a stream. I don't do this all the time, but I sure as shit was not paying money to see this pay-per-view. And by the way, I didn't pay money to see Victory Road. And before all the idiots out there go, well, then you have no right to complain. No, I watched a nice part, not the entire pay-per-view, but I watched a good chunk of this pay-per-view, which wasn't all horrible, by the way, but the ending was so atrocious that even then I said, this is a shit pay-per-view, and even though I didn't spend one red cent on it, I still feel like I'm owed my money back. That's not a good feeling right there. Here's some of the things, and really it's two things. There's two things about this show that piss me off. Number one, they've done this time and time again, and I think I even said on this show once before that TNA's mentality is they book for their one big episode of Impact on free TV each month. They're not even focused so much on the pay-per-views anymore. They do the pay-per-views because they think they have to. They think it's wrestling. Pay-per-views are a part of wrestling. We feel obligated to have to do them. And of course, that's horseshit, because if they didn't want to do pay-per-views, they could easily stop doing pay-per-views. Even if they have some sort of agreement with cable companies that needs to be fulfilled, fine, fulfill it, and then stop doing fucking stupid pay-per-view shows. But nonetheless, they did it again with Victory Road, where they used a pay-per-view that cost people somewhere in the range of $35 to $45, depending on whether or not you have HD, to plug a free Impact show. They did it with the Kurt Angle, Jeff Jarrett, Karen Angle stuff, those awful skits that went absolutely nowhere. And they did it with the RVD Ken Anderson match, where both men were counted out of the ring. They were trying to determine a number one contender to the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. So Anderson, being the fucking idiot that he is, does his finishing move on RVD, I guess on the steel, on the outside, on the ramp, or whatever the hell it was, and knocks himself out, knocks out RVD. They both get counted out. Half the crowd is chanting, restart the match. The other crowd is chanting, no, because the match was fucking terrible. They don't want to see this match twice in a row. And the match, in fact, was not restarted, and there was a no decision. So it was unclear as far as who would be the number one contender. And, of course, on commentary, you have Taz and Mike Tenay, or whoever it was, basically saying that to find out what's going to happen and the resolution to this, you got to watch Impact on Thursday. Now, I have no problem plugging your TV show on the pay-per-view, but there's a difference between plugging your TV show on the pay-per-view and saying, hey, don't forget, watch Impact on Thursday nights on Spike TV, and using the pay-per-view as a promotional vehicle for the free show. So the people who paid money to see some sort of resolution here, is it going to be RBD? Is it going to be Ken Anderson? Instead of getting that, it was left completely unclear, to the point where you didn't have to pay any money for this pay-per-view, and you wouldn't have missed a goddamn thing. To me, it's a slap in the face to the, quote, diehards and the hardcores who actually still shell out money, or have their parents, let's be honest, shell out money for these pay-per-view shows. It's a slap in their face. You know, the way I kind of look at it, really hardcore, diehard, lifelong TNA fans are like abuse victims. They're like the victims in an abusive relationship. They consistently get the shit kicked out of them. They get smacked around. People try to convince them they have to get out of this relationship. It's an abusive relationship. It will not end well. It will not go anywhere. And these people make up all the excuses in the world, and they stay in that relationship. That's exactly what TNA fans are. They are abuse victims who don't know any better. And they're just going to continue getting the shit kicked out of them and smacked around because that's what they do. And the other thing about this pay-per-view, you don't need me to tell you this, of course, is the so-called main event. So here's the story on this. And this is why I'm happy I didn't do a podcast immediately after the show, because I knew there would be more details about this that came out. And there were. The picture is a little bit more clear now than it was a week ago. So the main event was Sting defending the TNA Championship against the former champion, Jeff Hardy of Immortal. Sting, of course, made his big comeback on the big March 3rd Impact, which was taped in Fayetteville, beat Jeff Hardy for the championship on that show. Again, live on free Impact. Fine. Whatever. So now he's defending the championship. Jeff Hardy gets his rematch. And they do the fancy main event world title match introductions with Jeremy Borash on ring announcing. They wait until both guys come out to do the intro. They really build this thing up. They have their, tail of the tape points that they run down before the match. And anyway, they play Jeff Hardy's music. Now, the first sign was Jeff Hardy's music is playing. And, you know, sometimes wrestlers will milk it a little bit, or they won't get their cue until a certain point. Let the music play a little bit, build it up a little bit, make the fans want to see you, and then send the person out there. Not the case here. Whatever was going on backstage, Jeff Hardy took his sweet-ass time coming to the ring. So his music played for about a full minute before he finally walked out. And he walks out. He's moving a little slowly, but whatever. He does those little things with his hands or whatever when he makes his entrances. He's got the face paint on. Comes down to the ring, and first thing I noticed is it looks like he's scuffling with some fans in the front row, almost like he was trying to grab somebody's sign or grab something out of their hand. I couldn't tell what was going on. But what I did notice was when he went to go climb the ring steps into the ring, it looked like he almost tripped and fell over. And I thought, wow, man, that's a interesting little botch there. He kind of saved himself, grabbed the ropes. He didn't fall down. I didn't think anything of it after that. Gets in the ring, and some other stuff going on. He had gone to talk to the referee, and then the referee threw the dreaded X symbol up. And I didn't notice this until I went back and watched it a second or third time. The match hasn't even started yet. The introductions are still going on, and the referee has an X that he is flashing to the hard camera. So then Sting comes out. He comes to the ring, and they're doing the intros for the match. Then the match starts, and Jeff Hardy he takes his shirt off, and he's taking forever. And actually, let me backtrack a little bit here, because even before this, Eric Bischoff comes out after Sting makes his entrance. So Eric Bischoff comes out, comes down to the ring. Bischoff goes over to Jeff Hardy and places the microphone strategically behind his back so the microphone won't pick up anything, and he says something to Jeff Hardy. And then Bischoff is kind of cutting a promo that doesn't really make a lot of sense, and he goes over to Sting, and he does the same thing. He puts the microphone behind his back, mutters something to Sting, and continues on with his promo, which, again, in hindsight, still doesn't make any sense at all. Because if Bischoff was coming down to the ring to relay some last-minute commands to these two guys, basically telling them, this is going to be a short match, we have a change of plans here, then why would he get on the microphone and make this match a no-holds-barred match? It's basically what he did. No disqualification, I think, is what he said. Which gets everybody, of course, all excited, because now they think, oh boy, it's a no DQ match. We're going to get a chair shot or table bumps or, you know, oh, this is going to be a fight. There's going to be blood tonight. It gets them all excited for what ended up being nothing at all. Now, Bischoff gets sucker punched by Sting. He's knocked out of the ring. Now Jeff Hardy takes his shirt off, and he teases throwing it into the crowd for fucking ever. I mean, it's fine for a heel to want to kind of get under the fans' skin, tease them, don't throw the shirt to them, and end up throwing the shirt down on the ground, which is what ended up happening, but he took forever to do it, to the point where Sting went to go lock up with him in the corner. And Jeff was very slow. He wasn't, you know, his reflexes were a little off here. Sting was basically cornering him in the corner, going to beat him up, and Jeff finally ducked his body through the rope so the ref would call for a break, even though the match hadn't started. Or maybe the bell did ring. I don't remember. But the point is, Jeff finally throws his shirt down, and now the match starts, and Sting basically just starts beating him up. Sting kicks him, he punches him, and then drags him out of the corner and gives him a scorpion death drop out of nowhere. And Sting goes for the pin. 1, 2. It looks like Jeff tried to kick out. Sting did everything in his power to hold him down. The referee counts 3. That's it. Match over. Your main event, your TNA pay-per-view main event, over. In 1 minute, 28 seconds. And the crowd, of course, they're kind of cheering, but it's almost like a shocked kind of cheer. People don't quite know what to make of it. I certainly don't know what to make of this. Jeff Hardy, who popped right up from Sting's finishing move, didn't even sell it. He popped up. He doesn't know what to make of this. And Sting has announced the winner. And that's it. Sting looked pissed off as all hell after the match. I don't know if that was because Jeff didn't sell his move. He was probably just pissed off at the whole situation. Because the bottom line is, Sting and Jeff Hardy had gone over their match earlier that day. They had an entire match planned out. So Sting probably was not happy that, you know, this great match the two of them had planned out had to be cut short because Jeff Hardy was under the influence of something. Now, as far as what the fuck was wrong with Jeff Hardy, nobody seems to know specifically what he was on, what happened in the hour or so before the match. Apparently, when he showed up, people thought he was okay. They didn't realize that he might not be okay until just before match time. They had to supposedly chase him down and practically drag him to the gorilla position to get, you know, ready for the match, to make his entrance. Perhaps that's why it took so long for him to come out. Nobody knows if he was drunk, if he was high, if he was on some sort of medication, maybe a combination of those things. Of course, we all know Jeff's past. It could be any number of things. Sting goes to leave. He's got his championship belt. The crowd is chanting bullshit. And Sting actually looks at the crowd and says, I agree, he says. And I kept thinking at this point, this can't possibly be the end of this pay-per-view. There's going to be, maybe Bischoff is going to come out and restart the match, or somebody new is going to attack Sting. Something is going to happen here. Nope. Taz and Tanay, they go to a video recap package of all the matches from the pay-per-view, including the so-called main event, and they go off the air. They never show Jeff Hardy on camera again. Except for this one shot of him leaning up against the bottom rope all shocked after he got pinned. That was the last time we saw Hardy on camera. And that's it. And Victory Road went off the air early. And I'm just sitting there and I just cannot believe what I just saw. And here's the thing. Here's who I feel sorry for in this situation. First of all, I don't feel sorry at all for TNA. Okay? I'll get to them in a second. But here's three parties who I feel sorry for. Number one, I feel sorry for the fans. Because even though the people in the Impact Zone don't pay for their tickets, so they technically didn't lose any money, and perhaps some of them are just visitors to Universal Studios, they're not even wrestling fans, but you have a lot of wrestling fans in that audience of 1,100 people, many of whom are probably diehard TNA fans. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for the people who paid money for the pay-per-view. I feel sorry for the people who didn't pay money for the pay-per-view but watched it anyway. Because these are wrestling fans. These are people who had enough of an interest to want to watch the match, to watch the show, and this is what they were treated to. At the end of the day, there would be no professional wrestling if you did not have fans and spectators in the audience or on television to watch the freaking show. And you wasted all of their time. Now, granted, you wasted about a minute and 28 seconds of their time, which is not a lot. But still, the fans get hurt the most in this. Number two, I feel sorry for Sting. Like I said, he and Hardy had the match completely worked out earlier. This is probably going to be Sting's last go-round with any sort of world championship, I'm guessing. Although this is TNA, so for all we know, Sting will lose the title and then get it back about another five times over the next couple of years. But, you know, here's a guy who still goes out there and tries to have a good match. And Sting is, what, 52 years old now? I think his shoulder is still not 100%. You know, physically, he's just, in some ways, a shell of what he used to be. Sting is not the Sting of even 5 years ago, let alone 15 years ago. But still, he goes out there, he's a professional, he tries to have a great show. He's been around this business a long, long time. Takes a lot of pride in his work. This is his first pay-per-view title defense since winning the championship back a couple of weeks ago. And this is the bullshit that he has to deal with. You know, he goes, like I said, if go back and watch the match. Jeff Hardy is taking forever to throw the shirt in the crowd. Sting is getting very agitated. He goes to pin Jeff Hardy. It looked like Jeff tried to kick out and almost like Sting shot on him just to make sure he kept him down on the mat. I don't believe that was part of any sort of work or angle at all. I know it's TNA and not to put anything past them, but that was not any sort of worked angle or worked shoot or anything like that. I really feel sorry for Sting. And the third party that I feel sorry for are the other TNA wrestlers who busted their ass, including AJ Styles and Matt Hardy. You know, I'll give credit where credit is due. They had, you know, a damn good match. And with the match they had, and even some of the other matches that I saw, I didn't see all of them, but, you know, you would have probably had, at best, a good pay-per-view. You know, even without the bullshit at the end, I don't know if it would have been a great pay-per-view, but you would have probably had an okay to good pay-per-view without the BS at the end. And instead, you could have had four-star matches up and down that card. But that finish ruined the entire thing. I mean, it absolutely fucking ruined the entire pay-per-view. So all the hard work from guys like Kazarian and AJ Styles and Matt Hardy flushed down the toilet. You know, there's an old expression, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And the finish to that pay-per-view was abysmal. Now, if I were running TNA, Jeff Hardy would have been fired on the fucking spot. Absolutely fired on the spot. I mean, if I'm Dixie Carter, and thank fucking Christ I'm not, but if I was, and I had given Jeff Hardy opportunity after opportunity after opportunity, and he fucked me again, I would have waited until he came through that curtain, even if he wasn't in the right frame of mind, and I would have fired him on the spot in front of that entire locker room. I would have been the locker room hero that night, because I haven't heard one person defend Jeff Hardy. Even Matt Hardy, who in the past has gone on his Twitter and said, "Don't believe everything you hear, it's all bullshit," he hasn't exactly come out and said that any of this is bullshit. Neither is Jeff Hardy, because they know it's not. What happened, happened. It cannot be denied. Now, I say this because even though I would have fired Jeff Hardy, and a lot of you probably would have fired Jeff Hardy or suspended Jeff Hardy or punished him in some meaningful way, the rumor on the street, which is only a rumor at this point, but it's loud enough to where I feel the need to mention it, is that TNA is already thinking about bringing Jeff Hardy back when this all blows over as a babyface, which is the better role for him. Don't get me wrong. You know, that heel turn for Jeff Hardy worked out about as well as the heel turn for Steve Austin did in 2001. You know, Jeff Hardy was the only, quote, draw that TNA had on the road for their house shows and merchandise and all that. And their ticket sales and such, since he turned heel, just have plummeted. So yeah, if Jeff Hardy was ever going to be brought back, it should be as a babyface. But forget that for a second. They're already thinking about bringing him back. Here is a guy that was so professional. He showed up for your pay-per-view show, and he's in the main event, mind you, fighting for the championship. He shows up in no condition to perform. He goes out there and makes a mockery of your organization, makes a mockery of Sting, makes a mockery of the fans. So much so to the point that the company feels the need to put out an announcement on their website telling fans, in so many words, that this pay-per-view, or at least this pay-per-view ending and what happened on the pay-per-view, was so atrocious that we feel the need to make this offer to you where we will provide 6 months of our on-demand service for free as a make-good on that atrocity that you saw last weekend on pay-per-view. Okay? That right there is a confirmation that they knew this show sucked. And by the way, that's a nice little offer for them to make. It doesn't make up for what happened. I mean, if I'm a TNA fan who actually did spend $40 or $45 on that pay-per-view show, nothing short of a full refund is what I would accept. Now, ironically, in light of the fact that this all happened this past weekend, Jeff Hardy's latest court hearing was this week in North Carolina, and surprise, surprise, it resulted in yet another continuance. Apparently, the DA's office is waiting on evidence from the State Bureau of Investigation relative to, I guess, some of the drugs that were found in his residence when he was first arrested back in 2009. Okay? September 11th, 2009 is when his home got raided by police. And they're still waiting on lab results, they claim, from the evidence that was secured all those years. You know, I don't even know what to say. And that's not even a reflection on Jeff Hardy or TNA. I don't know who that's a reflection on, if it's the police department, if it's the lab who's working on the results. I don't buy any of this bullshit. This stinks to high heaven here. How are you still waiting on lab results from evidence that was secured, let's see, September 2009? So you're talking a year and a half. It doesn't make any sense. Here's the kicker, though, by the way. One of the newspaper articles, it might have been the Charlotte Observer or one of the papers in the Carolinas, did an article on this, and they obtained a quote from Stephen Godfrey, who is a spokesman for TNA, works in their PR department, and he noted that there is a drug testing policy in TNA, but company officials don't release the details. This is what he said. I answered a question about this, by the way, in the latest SE Scoops mailbag on the main page, which went up this past I believe it was Thursday this week. I put the mailbag up. Go back and read the question and the answer I gave in the mailbag, which sheds a little bit more light on this. It's funny that TNA claims they have a drug testing policy, and I'm sure they have a very basic drug testing policy. I'm not saying they don't have one, but it's an interesting policy in that they don't tell you anything about it. They don't tell you what they test for. They don't tell you how many times a year they test each performer. They don't tell you what happens if a performer is caught, what the punishment is, if any. Apparently there is none, because we've never, ever heard one single case of a wrestler being punished or suspended or fired or fined in any way for failing a drug test. We don't know if they test for steroids, if they test for just street narcotics. We know nothing about this supposed TNA drug testing policy. TNA feels there's no need to publicly disclose details of this policy. And by the letter of the law, they're not a publicly traded company or anything. They don't have to tell us anything. I just find it interesting that that's their answer in a week where Jeff Hardy showed up in the condition that he did at their pay-per-view, and they feel there's no need to publicly disclose any information about their supposed drug testing policy. I find that fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So, yeah. Jeff Hardy sucks. TNA sucks. This supposed make-good, you know, offering the 6 months of free on-demand where you could probably go back and watch some really great TNA matches from, like, 7 or 8 years ago. That's all well and good, but it doesn't make up for the bullshit they put on pay-per-view last weekend. I don't blame anybody except... I don't even blame Jeff Hardy. I cannot even blame Jeff Hardy for this. This is not Jeff Hardy's fault. TNA knew exactly what they were getting themselves into when they brought him into the company. They knew exactly what they were getting themselves into when, even though he was still facing pending drug charges and potential jail time, they put their world championship on him. They put him in the main event. They put him on every TV show every week like he's the biggest star in the company. This is TNA's fault. This is not Jeff Hardy's fault. They knew exactly what they were getting themselves into. I have no sympathy for this wretched organization whatsoever. They got exactly what they deserved. And like I said, for the fans' sake, it's a shame because they deserve better. I mean, there are people who are genuine diehard TNA fans. God bless their soul. I'll never understand why. Because as much as I know they have all the talent in the world under contract, they have a lot of great talent. How they use that talent and the things that they do on a routine basis, even more so than the stupid shit WWE does, it boggles the mind how TNA can have anything even closely resembling a loyal, dedicated fan, let alone any of those 5 or 8 or 10,000 people who actually do pay money for their pay-per-view shows. I could live to be 100 and never understand it. But like I said, God bless those people. If that's what they like, if they like seeing things like what they saw on pay-per-view last weekend, I don't understand it, but to each their own. Let's talk about Raw from this past Monday night. I got a lot of thoughts on this show, which started out in pretty entertaining fashion, I have to admit. The Rock, unfortunately, was yet again not there live, which is okay with me because I've actually enjoyed these two taped promos that he's done over the last couple of weeks. These two taped Rock promos are better than most of the in-ring live promos on Raw. So I thought this promo with the kid was great. I could have done without the cheesy promo music when he addressed The Miz in a more serious tone at the end of the promo. They've done this, by the way, in the past with, I think they did it with Matt Hardy after he turned heel on Jeff back in 2009. I think Matt was in the ring on SmackDown cutting a promo on Jeff, and they played this music, I think, while they showed clips of the Hardy Boys in the past or something for added effect. They did it for sure with Kane last year with some of those, those promos that Kane did during the Undertaker feud where he would talk and talk for like 12 minutes straight. And the soliloquies that he memorized and did in front of the live audience, and they piped in that crappy music. That's basically what they did here. It almost killed the end of the promo for me, but Rock still did a damn fine job. Basically, The Rock said that John Cena will never be as good as him, which is true. And he asked the kid who... The kid was great. The kid was dressed up in John Cena attire, pretending to be a kiddie version of Cena, which is basically what Cena is. And anyway, Rock asked the kid if he knew why Cena would never be as good as him, and the kid said it's because he's not that talented. And The Rock agreed that John Cena just is not that talented. So he makes the kid cry. He gives him a John Cena shirt, which he says is the next best thing to toilet paper. Had him blow his nose in it. Although I have to say, when The Rock spat into the shirt, I popped huge. It was disgusting, but it was great. So I love The Rock when he plays subtle heel, which is, to me, that's what he's doing here. He's very, in a subtle way, he's playing the role of heel here in this feud, even though I still think most people support him over Cena. Because, again, nothing he has said so far about John Cena is untrue. So why hate on The Rock? But, again, the problem is that without a match or some sort of meaningful payoff between these two guys, this will end in nothing but disappointment. For now, don't get me wrong, I'm loving the shit out of this. And I don't know how much longer Rock is going to be making appearances from week to week on WWE television. At this point, he's only scheduled through the Raw the night after WrestleMania. And then he'll be making a apparently a guest appearance on one of the episodes of Tough Enough that's already been taped. But again, Rock is in the next Fast and the Furious film, which is coming out, I believe, April 22nd. I'm sure he's going to be doing the media rounds for that movie. And he's still making movies, so I don't know how much longer we have with The Rock, so I'm just lapping it all up while he's still around. And there's been a bit of an interesting twist here. Before I get to the other Raw thoughts, I may as well just talk about this now. I've had people writing into me asking me questions about, what do you think about The Rock saying that he's going to come back and wrestle another match? And I was puzzled by these comments because in nothing that I've read this week have I seen any quote attributed to The Rock, or at least accurately attributed to The Rock, where he has basically said, I will wrestle again. He has not said that. But in the new issue of WWE Magazine, The Rock is on the cover. And inside is an interview with him discussing his career and his comeback. And so The Rock was asked about how much of his old ring outfits he still owns. And he said he owns them all. They're still in his house. They were never going to go away because he knew that one day he would use them again. So then he gets asked, does that mean you're going to come back to fight as well? And instead of responding the way that he's responded now for years, that he quietly retired in 2004, he's not wrestling again, but he wants to continue to entertain, he'll always be a part of the WWE, blah, 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 he gave a very interesting response. And I think this is probably what people are referring to. He said, making movies is something that I love to do, and I know that it brings a lot of people joy, which in turn brings me and my soul great gratification. Being in the ring and entertaining the audience and kicking ass physically brings me and my soul great gratification as well. I can guarantee that I can always do both. So, in one respect, this is a bit of a different answer than he's given in the past, which tells me that he is at least contemplating some sort of comeback, probably a match with John Cena. Could be at a big pay-per-view like SummerSlam, maybe WrestleMania next year in Miami, his home, where he played with the Hurricanes in college. Or this can mean nothing at all. This could just be Rock, speaking from the heart and saying, I know that in my heart, if I wanted to wrestle again and make movies, I could do that. Nowhere in the interview does he say he's coming back to wrestle a match. Okay, let's not twist his words into a pretzel and make them into something that they're not. So before we all get excited and say, oh, see, The Rock changed his mind, he's going to come back and wrestle, this does not mean he's going to come back and wrestle. But I admit, it is it's a different response than he has given to that question in the past. Let's see here. Raw. Michael Cole. Good old Michael Cole and his coal mine box. By the way, I lost my shit when my Facebook page, cheap plug, by the way, facebook.com/thesolomonster. Somebody posted a question this week asking me, he said he hasn't watched WWE in a while, and he wanted an explanation as to why Michael Cole was sitting in a box. Just the absurdity of that question. Just when you listen to that question out loud, it's not the person's fault who asked the question. It's a perfectly logical question. If I had not been watching Raw in many months and I put it on and saw Michael Cole sitting in a glass encased box, I too would wonder why the fuck he was sitting in one of those. But it just, to me, illustrates the absurdity of pro wrestling and why I love it so much. I will say that even though I love the coal mine, I still prefer Jim Ross's old little announce desk when he did that heel angle in 99. When, Michael Cole, ironically, back in 99, had replaced him because JR was suffering from his second bout of Bell's palsy, and Jim Ross's face was still kind of disfigured, for lack of a better term. And he wasn't quite ready to come back facially just yet, but he came back anyway. He was being a heel. He said, you took my job, nobody can do this better than me, and he set up a little tiny announce desk in front of the actual one. And this only lasted a couple of weeks, and then they dropped the whole thing. But I like that a little bit better than this. But this was still great. Then we had the angle in the middle of the show. And Michael Cole had teased that he was going to bring back somebody from Jerry Lawler's past to confront him and to prove that Lawler was a hypocrite, he was selfish, he was interested and out for nobody but himself. So when Cole was on the microphone just about to bring the person out, at first I thought maybe it was Jimmy Hart. And then when Cole actually got on the mic and mentioned that it was a member of Jerry's own family, the first thought that popped into my head was, holy shit, he's going to bring out the Honky Tonk Man. Honky Tonk Man, for those of you who don't know, is actually a cousin of Jerry Lawler's, and he has had some very unflattering things to say about the King in the past. I know, there's a shock right there. Honky Tonk Man talking shit about other wrestlers. But it, in fact, was not the Honky Tonk Man. It was Brian Christopher, the real-life son of Jerry the King Lawler, former member of Too Cool in WWE, the tag team with Scotty Too Hotty. And he came out. He was doing his old Too Cool dance moves. I mean, from the moment he walked out on the stage, he was dancing. He danced to the ring. He danced inside the ring. And he did a pretty good job of dancing. And then he got on the microphone. And unfortunately, all of that dancing resulted in him blowing himself up. He could barely breathe. I mean, he was huffing and puffing into the microphone during his promo like he had COPD. This guy could not catch a breath. And the poor bastard, nobody knew who he was, or at least they didn't care. He got no reaction from the crowd. So, you know, for what it was, I actually kind of liked this. It was a little unnerving, you know, the things he was saying, and then he was pushing his father around. I thought it was a great angle. I understand that Cole is doing everything in his power to really get under Lawler's skin, and what better way to do that than to enlist the services of his own flesh and blood to talk shit about him on national television? And I thought Christopher made a very interesting point when, you know, he mentioned to Lawler that it must bother you that I got my WrestleMania match before you ever did, which is a cool point. I'm actually kind of happy they brought that up, because that's an interesting thing I had not thought about. You know, Lawler, who's been in this business for 40 years, he's 61 years old, he's finally going to get the WrestleMania match that has eluded him his entire career. I mean, legitimately, he has wanted a WrestleMania match for years, and Vince McMahon always forgot or blew him off. He's finally going to get the match. It means a lot to him. Genuinely means a lot to him. And here's his son on TV talking crap about him, reminding him that I wrestled at WrestleMania before you did. So I thought that was cool. So then we got the return of Jim Ross. We hear the Boomer Sooner music, the Oklahoma Fight song. Out comes JR looking pretty good. Got a nice reception from the crowd. Called Michael Cole a rat bastard during his promo. Threatened to fight him. He's taken off his jacket. Took off his tie. I was praying he wasn't going to take off his shirt. Thankfully, he didn't. Jack Swagger comes out of the crowd. Beats up Jerry Lawler. Then slides into the ring and puts Jim Ross in the ankle lock. Now, apparently, JR was really hurt during this segment. I know people are saying he's working everybody on Twitter by talking about going to the doctor and, you know, actually suffering an injury and everything. And who's to say? I mean, nobody knows for sure. I tend to believe him when he says he actually did get hurt. It's not a serious injury, but apparently Swagger, you know, took things a little too far, got a little excited, and was cranking and twisting on his leg and his ankle a little too much. Apparently, Ross went to the doctor during the week, claims to have stretched some ligaments in his ankle and his knee, but I certainly would expect him at this point to play some sort of role at WrestleMania. He will be at WrestleMania regardless. He's signing autographs during the Access Fan Festival. Otherwise, he'll be there as a guest. I would expect him to at least make an appearance of some kind during the Cole match. I personally would expect him to announce on the pay-per-view. If he doesn't announce the entire show, maybe just the main event, maybe he'll announce just for the Michael Cole-Jerry Lawler match. Last I heard, they were seriously considering taking Lawler and Cole off the show as announcers completely, and just having them on there to wrestle their match. Which, if you think about it, depending on the positioning of their match on the pay-per-view, makes sense. It would be a little awkward if, you know, here's one of the best promoted matches of WrestleMania, and the two combatants are both at ringside calling the pay-per-view, and then all of a sudden they have to get up and go get ready for their match. It's kind of stupid when you really stop and think about it. But I don't know that WrestleMania should be called exclusively by Josh Matthews, Matt Stryker, and Booker T. I mean, you've got the greatest wrestling announcer of all time at the show, in the building, ready to rock and roll. You know, JR has said if he is called upon, he is ready to do the job. He would love to announce at WrestleMania again. And it would be foolish of them not to put him in that role for at least a couple of matches. I predict that he will call at least some of the action, if not the entire pay-per-view. So, a couple of other Raw notes here. I thought that having Alex Riley run in on the Miz Great Khali match was fucking stupid. Not because Riley is supposed to be fired, and apparently he's... Apparently, based on something he said at the MSG house show yesterday, he's going to be on Raw this week in a match, or at least he has somehow communicated with the anonymous Raw general manager and ask for a match where he can try to win back his job on Raw. A job, apparently, that he never lost since he's on the MSG house show, so I can't quite explain that. But he ran in on this match, and it's stupid just because it makes your champion look like a dweeb when he can't beat a guy like the Great Khali on his own. So that was my thoughts on that. The Undertaker Triple H build to their match at WrestleMania is not doing anything for me at all. Apparently they have some great video package ready to rock this weekend on television. And I know they've recorded comments with people like Steve Austin and Harley Race, obviously Shawn Michaels, getting comments from them to kind of hype up the match. I think that's a great thing, but man, this build-up, it's just, they just talk and talk and talk, and it's just not going anywhere. And, you know, the plan is still to have their match end the show at WrestleMania. I just think that's a huge mistake. You don't know what you're going to get with The Undertaker physically, and even Triple H for that matter, although Triple H, I'm sure, is going to be just fine. I'm hearing now he might actually wrestle a match on Raw this week, which if he wrestles his first match back on television on the Raw before the pay-per-view, I don't know what they're thinking. I hope that doesn't happen, but I just think you're taking a huge risk. Not that there's no interest in the match, because there is, but Cena and The Miz as a match is another match I don't care about, but you have The Rock as the X Factor, and people are going to buy this pay-per-view in many cases because of The Rock, or they're going to buy it because of the possibility there could be some sort of confrontation between John Cena and The Rock. That should end the show, in my opinion. Apparently, they've also decided against the streak versus career stipulation and having Shawn Michaels as the guest referee. So, for those of you who are asking, when are they going to announce HBK as the referee? Probably at this point, ain't going to happen. I guess they feel that this match is going to succeed or not succeed based on how many people honestly believe Triple H can break the streak. And if that's what they're banking on, then I'm willing to bet not too many people are going to buy into that. We saw Sheamus winning the United States Championship on Raw from Daniel Bryan. Of course, Bryan has the best match on the show. Again, it's it's also not surprising to me that the crowds really, really, really get into his matches. I mean, if you watch most Daniel Bryan matches, and again, he's treated basically as a mid-card guy, but they really do get into his matches, they get into his comebacks, they get into his near falls. That doesn't happen with everybody else, but they happen in a majority of his matches, so I hope they're paying attention to that. Anyway, they had the best match on the show. They're probably going to have a rematch at WrestleMania. I hope they do, and I hope they get a little more time, because I think they could really, potentially, Daniel Bryan's very first WrestleMania, yeah, I think it's safe to say that he might go out there and steal the show. I know Cody Rhodes has been saying in interviews that him and Rey Mysterio are going to steal the show at WrestleMania. I hope they do. This is a really, really big opportunity for Cody Rhodes, and I'm glad to see him getting it. He can thank Rey Mysterio for that, as we've talked about before on this show. Let's see what else happened here. So much for the new Nexus. Mason Ryan was the last member of the new Nexus that was eliminated by a Randy Orton punt kick, which one of our listeners renamed the FCW, or the Florida Kick. By the way, I'm not sure if these guys are actually being sent down to FCW or not. Husky Harris, I would not expect to see him back for a while, but wouldn't shock me if these guys pop back up, if not at WrestleMania, then after the pay-per-view. I will say that I do like the build to Randy Orton and CM Punk. In some ways, it's kind of basic, but they've been building this very nicely. Again, Orton and Punk is not the main event on the show, so you got to be careful. You don't want this match and the build-up to it to overshadow everything else. But Orton has slowly but surely eliminated each member of Punk's faction. When Punk tried to get in the ring on Raw Monday night, Orton kind of cut him off, and Orton didn't go after him, which at the time I thought, well, that's pretty fucking stupid. You got CM Punk right in front of you. Why don't you try to attack him? He's been making your life a living hell now for weeks. But then I kind of saw the visual that they had with these two guys kind of staring a hole through each other, and then Punk slowly slithers out of the ring, and I thought that was a really cool visual. And it's a way to keep them away from each other for at least another week if you want to save the physical stuff for the pay-per-view. So I thought that was actually really well done. Trish Stratus loses to Vicky Guerrero in their match. I think I predicted that last week, but she could thank Lay Cool for that. They interfered. Michelle McCool kicked Trish in the head with her loaded boot as she recovers from her foot injury, her legitimate foot injury. I expected it, I was fine with it, and it sets up the six-person tag at WrestleMania with the troll doll, I mean Snooki. Snooki will wrestle at WrestleMania. She'll team up with John Morrison and Trish Stratus against Lay Cool and Dolph Ziggler, and Vicky, I assume, will be in their corner. Probably will end up getting beaten up by Snooki at the pay-per-view. I have no problem with this. You could argue that John Morrison deserves better, or it would have been better to do a singles match with him and Ziggler, but you know what? They're going to get publicity. They're already getting publicity out of this. Morrison may not be in the best match on the show, but he'll be in one of those matches that's promoted as one of the big attractions on the pay-per-view because of Snooki. And so maybe he'll get some rub out of it. You know, at least he's on the Mania show. Kofi Kingston doesn't have a match, for example. He's the Intercontinental Champion. I mean, if he even gets on the card, it'll probably be in some sort of meaningless battle royal. So at least John Morrison and Dolph Ziggler are actually going to get a Mania payoff, which I think is great because they deserve it. Then you have the main event. John Cena and Alberto Del Rio. It was billed as the first ever confrontation between the two of them. Then again, you know, does it really matter? I mean, my first thought was, why do this match now? And then I thought, well, it doesn't matter. People are going to forget about this match and the fact that it even happened by next week, so who cares? They had an okay match. It was a fuck finish, which I figured it would be. They had The Miz come out. For the fourth week in a row, he beat up John Cena. Miz came out dressed up as The Rock, and I was shocked. Not by the fact that he was dressed up as The Rock, but if you go back and watch, there's one scene when they panned out to the crowd after Miz had already walked out, and it was obvious that he, you know, most people already figured out Miz was going to do this, that it wasn't, in fact, The Rock coming out, it was The Miz. He was wearing a bald cap and The Rock's t-shirt. But there were some women in the audience who were still screaming. They actually thought it was The Rock. I couldn't believe it. So anyway, he comes out, beats up John Cena for the fourth week in a row. And by the way, Miz, we almost lost the WWE champion this week. You know, he tweeted that after the show, his flight was about to take off. The nose of the plane was already in the air. And then the plane's right engine blew. So thankfully, the plane never actually did take off, and he got deferred to a different flight. Thank God for that, because, you know, I mean, then we would have had to have some sort of tournament for the title, which Vince McMahon hates. So anyway, they're trying with The Miz. They're really trying. I think it's too little too late. People at this point just do not care about this. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm speaking for a lot of people when I say that. This is just completely and totally all been about Cena and The Rock. And perhaps they thought that by doing it this way, The Miz would get some rub from these two guys. They would look at The Miz as being in the same league as Cena and The Rock. And to me, they have just failed in epic fashion. You know, the damage has been done. He's an afterthought. That's what he is. And I'm sure that since he's the one ripping off The Rock's moves, you know, he did the People's Elbow a couple weeks ago. He did the Rock Bottom to Cena on Monday night. I'm sure he'll be the one eating a Rock Bottom and a People's Elbow at the pay-per-view, but I don't think that's what the fans really want to see. I really just don't think they're going to care. And The Rock is going to be on Raw next week. So the go-home show, which I believe is on the 28th, he will be there. I'm sure they'll be promoting the shit out of it. At least they better this time. And wouldn't shock me on that show if they tease a Cena-Rock confrontation and then before something happens, The Miz comes out, his music plays to interrupt things, and somehow the show ends with Miz beating up both The Rock and John Cena, leaving them both laying. In fact, I almost expect that's the way the final Raw before the pay-per-view would end, and even then, it will not make a difference. Last note here, interesting to note that the Raw overrun, for the first time in forever, actually lost viewers in the ratings. So nobody believed Michael Cole at all when he teased that The Rock would be there. It was during the main event that Cole on commentary was going nuts, saying that he has it on good authority or somebody told him that The Rock would be there. I don't think anybody in the world believed that. And apparently the people at home didn't believe it either because people tuned out and they did not tune in. That's the price you pay, by the way, when you turn your play-by-play guy into an annoying prick heel. Nobody takes anything he says seriously. Another reason that they ought to work Jim Ross back into the mix somehow. Drew Carey is the latest inductee into the WWE Hall of Fame in the celebrity wing. This just reeks of Kevin Dunn, by the way. I won't even blame Vince McMahon. I'm almost positive it's Kevin Dunn's responsible for this. But From what I understand, Drew Carey is going to be inducted by Bob Barker, which is kind of interesting. I guess that would explain why they're doing it. Bob Barker, for the benefit of those of you who don't know, Bob Barker did guest host on Raw last year, and he's been an icon in American television for over 50 years. He retired a couple of years ago, and he hosted a whole bunch of game shows during his career, but he's most well known for hosting a show called The Price is Right. And Drew Carey, comedian Drew Carey, was the one that was handpicked to take over the reins of Price is Right when Bob retired. And Drew Carey, of course, himself did make an appearance once upon a time. They showed footage of it on Monday night. He was a guest in the 2001 Royal Rumble and had a fun little confrontation with Kane before eliminating himself by jumping over the top rope. Very smart man. And I could think of just a slew of other celebrities who also appeared one time who deserve more to go into the Hall of Fame than Drew Carey, including Bob Barker, by the way. And I know Bob Barker wasn't in the Royal Rumble, but Bob Barker's appearance on Raw last year was a big hit. And I'd put him in the Hall of Fame before I would put Drew Carey in the Hall of Fame. But I'm guessing they're doing it because Bob's going to be there, and it would be a potentially a great media coup for them to, you know, have footage of the old Price is Right host Bob Barker interacting with and inducting the new host into the WWE Hall of Fame. So there you go. And I mentioned this also because of another funny, sad, depressing, angering story. I posted this on Facebook yesterday. I first posted it there. I couldn't help myself. Had to post it there first. Another cheap plug for Facebook, by the way. And story goes a little something like this. TV Week posted a story after Raw, sometime during the week after Raw Monday night. They posted a small story, it was probably 3 or 4 paragraphs, on their website, announcing that Drew Carey was, in their words, their headline was something to the effect of, Drew Carey elected, which is funny in and of itself, elected to the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. And it was a very straightforward story, basically announcing that Drew Carey, who once appeared for the WWF at the time, was being inducted into their Hall of Fame as part of their class of 2011 on April 2nd in Atlanta, Georgia. And this is just unbelievable to me. So you figure, okay, no big deal. It's a little blurb. They posted on their website. This is exactly what WWE was hoping for when they announced Drew Carey in the first place. I mean, I'm sure, again, they wanted that photo op of him and Bob Barker, if Bob Barker is, in fact, the one inducting him. I say that because that's the impression I'm under. Maybe I'm wrong. But they, more so than anything else, they were hoping to garner some attention this week in the media by announcing this. They even put a press release out. I don't think they put a press release out to announce, for example, Bullet Bob Armstrong going into the Hall of Fame, but I wouldn't expect them to. So they got the media attention they were hoping for, but apparently that's not good enough. And in fact, WWE was actually rather angry at this story. Now, why were they angry, you might ask? Well, I'm glad you asked, because basically, this is the short story here. One of the publicists who worked for WWE demanded that TV Week correct their inaccurate story. You might ask, what's so inaccurate about it? Drew Carey inducted into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. What's so horrible about that? Apparently, this publicist on behalf of WWE sent an email to the author of the article. And her message stated as follows. We are no longer a wrestling company, but rather a global entertainment company with a movie studio, international licensing deals, publisher of 3 magazines, consumer good distributor, and more. By the way, you're boasting that you are a company that produces 3 magazines, but they're wrestling magazines. So anyway, she wants the headline changed because she feels it's inaccurate. They are not a wrestling company. They do not employ wrestlers. They employ superstars and divas. But that's not even the kicker. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to read you the brief transcript of the conversation here. That the author posted in his article, because they went back and forth with some emails, and then finally they got one another on the telephone, and he basically transcribed how the conversation went. So the author of the article says, your press release states that Drew Carey is being recognized as being an entrant in the 2001 Royal Rumble. I believe that was a wrestling event. And the publicist responds, nope, we don't do wrestling events. They're entertainments. I swear to God, that is what she said. They're not wrestling events, they're entertainments. What the fuck does that even mean? What is an entertainment? This conversation right here is an entertainment. She says, we don't call them wrestlers, they're superstars and divas. So the reporter continues, he says, listen, I don't really have time for this bullshit. Although he didn't say bullshit. WWE presents wrestling events. I'm not going to change the headline or anything in the item. If you'd like, I'll just remove it. And her response is, what? And he says, I don't have time for this. What do you want me to do? And she says, remove it. And that's exactly what he did. He removed the item. And then apparently the publicist sent him an email following up after the phone call saying, I hope nothing was contentious in our conversation. She says, I know the perception is that we are a wrestling company, but we are actually much more than that. We are a global media company, which is how our chairman and CEO, Vince McMahon, positions us. So the lesson here is that you and I, and we've probably known this already for years, but you and I don't watch wrestling shows on Monday nights. You and I, we watch entertainments. So, you know, this big pay-per-view they have coming up in a couple of weeks, the so-called granddaddy of them all, you know, the show that The Rock is hosting. The Rock is not hosting WrestleMania. Oh, no. The Rock is hosting Entertainment Mania. Because the word wrestling, or wrestle, is in the name of the fucking pay-per-view. The word wrestling is in the name of the company. It's World Wrestling Entertainment. It's not World Media Entertainment. It's World Wrestling Entertainment. And people wonder why Bruno Sammartino keeps rejecting the offers that he gets from WWE to go into their Hall of Fame. Here's a company that's so ashamed of the industry that they're in, they refuse to even acknowledge that it has anything at all to do with wrestling, even though wrestling is in their fucking name. They just refuse to accept it. They refuse to acknowledge it. They don't have wrestling events. They have entertainments. That's got to be the line. It's only March, but that's got to be the line of 2011 right there. Entertainment. I just cannot get over that. You know, what's funny about this whole thing is that Vince McMahon he's had this thing now for years where he doesn't like the word wrestling. It's like a dirty word to him. And, you know, they're trying to position their company more and more as being something other than pro wrestling. And even though the name of the company changed all those years ago, they still have the word wrestling in their name. Even TNA doesn't have wrestling in their name. It's total nonstop action. They're the company that actually doesn't even have the word wrestling in their name. But Vince McMahon is just he's so hell-bent on changing the perception that people have of his company without realizing that no matter what he does, people will always think wrestling when they hear the initials WWE. There's absolutely no amount of marketing that you could possibly do to reposition yourself as anything but a wrestling company. And he just refuses to accept that. And he scared his employees so much that this woman, who may not even be all that crazy, I'm sure she's a very fine, very nice lady, probably got her directives from the top, and maybe she's seen other people get bitched at and get into trouble or get fired for making similar mistakes. And she just felt compelled to send this abrasive email demanding that this publication change their own headline because it's actually right, but she says it's wrong. That takes a lot of balls there to do something like that. So just to piss off WWE, you're a wrestling company. Get over it. Don't be ashamed of it. Embrace it. A couple of other WWE bits here, and then I'll get back to TNA. I'm not done with them yet. Oh, no. Oh, no, no, no. GLAAD, which is an organization that represents gays and lesbians, they have had issues in the past with some of the content on WWE programming, and they took issue yet again with something that actually aired on television last month. But they put this statement out that, it was almost like a statement to announce they had this issue, and WWE responded in the affirmative and said that they would take every measure and every step to make sure nothing like this happens again. They took umbrage with John Cena's battle rap, or his freestyle, I should say. His first response to The Rock, not the knockout blow. That dreaded knockout blow that John Cena delivered the week, last week, I guess it was. But that first promo where he made a couple of cracks about, you know, Brokeback Mountain, and then there was a different promo where he, think it was the one where he put his arm around The Miz when they were making fun of Alex Riley. That was the night that Riley got, quote, fired as Miz's apprentice. But Cena earlier in the show was cracking jokes about the two of them and insinuating some sort of gay relationship. It was the same stupid, lame, lowbrow WWE comedy that isn't even funny. I wasn't particularly offended by it, but I guess I could see where some people would be. I still think we're way too politically correct today, but that's my opinion. But nonetheless, GLAAD took issue with this, and WWE responded and basically said, "We're sorry. We're sorry." That's what they said. They tucked their tail between their legs. And again, I'm not saying that we should eliminate stupid comedy like this that really doesn't have any place in pro wrestling. When I say they tucked their tail between their legs, if WWE really felt strongly about the content of their show and standing behind it, they wouldn't tuck their tail and kowtow to every group and every organization that takes them to task for their programming. They would stand up for themselves and say, "We, you know, refute these allegations. We are not a sexist or racist or, you know, whatever organization. We support our content. That, you know, and basically just stand up for themselves." And the fact that they didn't do that basically is an acknowledgement that, you know, they don't. It's not that they feel passionately about their own content. They realize they did something stupid. They're trying to please everybody when that's just impossible to do. And it's just another illustration to all the people that have written into me over the last couple of weeks, feeling that all of the, not foul language, but we've seen a lot more adult language used in some of these segments, especially the Rock John Cena stuff, you know, and the word ass and the word bitch and you know, the stuff in those, especially that first Cena promo, which was refreshing in that it was different than the types of promos Cena delivers today, was very much like those old promos he would cut back in 2003, for example, or 2004, which were a lot more racy, pushing the envelope. All these people that have been emailing me saying, "Oh, it's the return of Attitude, it's the return of TV-14. Let this be a lesson to all of you. There is no such thing as a return to Attitude. The Attitude Era is dead. The Attitude Era is not coming back. Which is not to say that at some point in a couple of years or at some point in the future, WWE would never go back to being PG-13. But the Attitude Era, as you and I know it, is never, ever coming back. And I said this to somebody, I responded in a direct email to somebody's email they sent me. And I'll say it here. You have to understand something. The Attitude Era was a direct result of WWE feeling threatened by the competition to the point where WCW had its foot on WWE's neck and was about to break its neck before WWE powered out and ultimately persevered over their competition. WWF, back in 1997, was legitimately on the brink of bankruptcy. Business was just bottoming out. They were in trouble. Their talent was being raided by WCW. Eric Bischoff was throwing money at anybody and everybody. He had Hogan. He had Savage. He got Hall and Nash. The NWO took off. And there were big problems in the WWF. And Vince McMahon made a decision. He said, "It's time to take a risk. My back is up against the wall. I've got no other alternative here." I'm sure some of the wrestlers were perhaps pressuring him as well to make the product a bit more adult-oriented and not as kid-friendly and cartoonish as it used to be. And ultimately, it helped them win the war. It wasn't the reason they won the war. The reason they won the war was because Steve Austin took off and The Rock took off and The Undertaker reinvented himself, and Mankind as a character took off, and they had all these athletes and these great stars that they put them out there and they showcased these talents, which WCW was doing a piss poor job of doing. I mean, you know, they would put the cruiserweights and the guys on the undercard, but the real focus was on the old main event guys who could barely move, and, you know, every week it was an NWO beatdown. You know, after a while that gets old. Guys like Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, they were not going to get a legitimate shot. You know, they gave Benoit the WCW title at the end because they tried to keep him. That's the only reason they gave him the belt. Okay, don't fool yourself. But anyway, the point is, it was a move of desperation that paid off. And what happened? Well, when WCW went out of business, it didn't happen right away. But you'll notice, you know, and it's true, the Parents Television Council and certain groups, they, you know, took umbrage with the WWF product, and certain sponsors pulled out, and that's when they got the message, and they said, "Okay, we're going to tone down the product a little bit." But it would have happened anyway. Vince McMahon, go back, if you were a WWF fan in the late 80s or the early 90s, Go back and watch the product back then. It was full of cartoon gimmicks. It was totally a family-friendly, kid-oriented product. I mean, that's always what Vince McMahon pushed. Always. And you'd have maybe an angle every now and then that would push the envelope a little bit. But by and large, that's what WWF was. That was always Vince McMahon's vision for what wrestling should be. And only when he felt threatened and he had no other option and he was getting his ass kicked every week did he say, it's time to go there. It's time to do what we need to do to survive. Because what we're doing now is not working. And then it worked. And it worked very, very well for them. And they made a lot of money. And Vince, now that he basically owns the wrestling landscape, has the power, which he does, to take the product back in a direction that he's more comfortable with. Believe it or not, Vince McMahon is a lot more supportive of the product as it is now than he ever was of the Attitude stuff. I mean, he would do interviews back then, and Linda McMahon would do interviews where even they would admit, you know, if I was a parent of a child who was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, I wouldn't let them watch wrestling. I bet they would now, but back then they wouldn't. So Vince McMahon is not in jeopardy of being threatened by Dixie Carter. He is not in jeopardy of being threatened by Ted Turner's big bank account anymore. You know, it's kind of like Dana White and the UFC. They just bought their competition. UFC is the only dominant MMA organization left in the world. WWE is pretty much the only really, truly dominant national, global wrestling organization left in the world. There is no imminent threat to them. There is no incentive for Vince McMahon to go, you know what? Let's go piss off Mattel and piss off all the other sponsors in this big deal we just signed with Kmart. Let's go piss off Kmart and we're going to revert back to the days when, you know, Mae Young gave birth to a hand and Mark Henry fondled the transvestite and DX was going out there every week telling people to suck their dick and Steve Austin was coming out on TV every week using words like asshole and shit and all this other stuff. Let's do that again because it's fun. If business in a couple of years was to dip to an alarmingly low level, with or without competition, let's say business is bad again, and maybe the company isn't on the brink of bankruptcy, because that, believe me, that ain't going to happen for a long, long time. They've got enough money coming in where even in a bad year, they're still turning a profit. But let's say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, things are looking pretty grim. And who even knows at that point if Vince McMahon will be in charge anymore? Maybe it'll be Triple H and Stephanie. Although, again, Triple H is more of an old school guy. I don't know that he would, you know, the first order of business under a Triple H regime would be, you know, reinstate the Attitude Era. It's just not going to happen. People seem to have this pipe dream that if John Cena turns heel or if this happens or if that happens, we're going to go back to the way it was 12 years ago. It ain't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. So I just, you know, I hope that puts this thing to bed and I stop getting emails about it, but I'm sure I'm still going to get them. But I just wish people would understand it's not so simple. You know, it's not like, oh, this is going to happen and we're going to get Attitude back. Attitude ain't coming back, and they could push the envelope. I like it more when they push the envelope, don't get me wrong. You know, hearing The Rock do a promo and calling John Cena, you know, yabba dabba bitch, it's refreshing almost to me. Because I'm not a kid anymore, you're not a kid anymore. I can handle it. But to think that we're going to go back to the way things were, you got to leave it in the past, because it's just not going to happen. WGN America canceled Superstars this week, which was kind of a shocking move almost. Apparently they had high hopes that Superstars would bring the network some big ratings, which makes me laugh, because anybody could have predicted that after those first couple of weeks when they kind of loaded up the show with real stars, that it was basically just going to become the modern-day version of Jacked or Metal or Velocity or Afterburn or Shotgun Saturday Night or any of those other C-level shows that WWE used to have. And I'll tell you what, more often than not, I read these reports for Superstars, and I bet Superstars probably has better matches than any of the main shows, but nobody watches it. And not everybody has WGN America. For example, I don't have WGN America. If I wanted to watch Superstars, I'd have to watch it on YouTube, which is fine, but not everybody has access to the station. So apparently they were very disappointed in that, and they decided that they would no longer air the show. I think the show will continue to air until maybe sometime next month, and then it will stop. And I don't know what the plan is at this point. I heard somebody say that they were going to run Superstar. They were going to keep running it as a web-only show like they do with NXT, perhaps in some parts of the globe where they still have contracts to fulfill. Perhaps they could fill that slot with Tough Enough. Maybe they'll air Tough Enough internationally. I don't think they can do that because I think Tough Enough is a USA show. But whatever they do, if you're a mid-card or a low-card talent who basically only gets to appear on Superstars each week, unless they do just turn it into a web-only show, you got to be a little worried. You know, it's almost that time of year now where WWE does their annual spring cleaning. And there's been some talk now for a couple of weeks that after WrestleMania is over, they could be looking to unload up to a dozen different names. And if you're a guy, and I don't know anything about any of this, so I'm not saying these guys are being fired, but again, if you're a guy like a Tyson Kidd, who is actually a pro on the current season of NXT, but that never stopped them from firing somebody before. So if you're a Tyson Kidd or a David Hart Smith or a Yoshi Tatsu or a Zack Ryder, who has been actually rather entertaining with his videos, and even John Cena on his Twitter has been promoting Zack Ryder's YouTube channel. And it sounds like somebody who's trying to do everything in his power to stop himself from getting fired, and I don't know if it's going to work or not. I hope it does. He seems like an entertaining enough guy. He had a little cameo on Raw Monday night where Snooki actually complimented him on his six-pack abs. I thought maybe she'd poke fun at him, but she really didn't. So I don't know what that means for him, but if I were a wrestler who pretty much only appears on Superstars, I'd be a little concerned right now. And lastly here on the WWE news front, the June 19th Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view has apparently been renamed Capital Punishment. That's capital with an O, by the way. That show emanating from the Verizon Center in our nation's capital of Washington, D.C. So if this is true, then it would appear that they have ditched Fatal 4-Way as being a pay-per-view concept. Hallelujah, by the way, if they have, because that pay-per-view died a death last year. I should know because I was at that show. And if this is if in fact there will be no more Fatal 4-Way pay-per-views, then I guess I have the honor of having appeared at the one and only Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view in WWE history. So there you go. I was also at the final Great American Bash pay-per-view before they turned it into The Bash. Back in 2008, I was at that show at the very same building, in fact, Nassau Coliseum, so it makes me feel special. All right, let's get back to TNA here, even though I don't want to, but I did catch part of Impact this week. I felt like I had to. There was so much talk coming out of Victory Road. I was not watching the show live, so I ended up watching it, piecing together different parts that people uploaded on YouTube. And I especially was interested in seeing Hulk Hogan's promo early in the show, because I read the taping results for Impact and heard that he had used the word tsunami in his promo. I think he might have referred to himself or maybe Immortal as the tsunami of wrestling, which is in such poor taste. And I know a little earlier I complained about people being a little too politically correct and politically sensitive, and I agree with that, but I'm just speaking personally, you know, knowing everything that's just happened in Japan, one of the greatest just disasters any country has ever had to endure. And for Hulk Hogan to go out there and you know, use it in such a way in the context of a wrestling promo, he just shouldn't have said it. I mean, it was a stupid fucking thing for him to say. And I was pretty sure it wasn't going to air on TV. Hogan himself had gone on Twitter the day or two after the tapings. And he apologized. He apologized. He said that it was going to be cut from the show. It would not air. He said, sometimes when cutting promos, things happen. Which is true, by the way. And I respect the fact that he did apologize for it. At least he recognized that it was a stupid thing to say. And unfortunately, that was not the only dumb remark that a TNA wrestler made, that the company actually felt the need to edit off the show. It was so bad, they had to cut it from the show. Hogan's tsunami comment was one. The other one came from somebody else who should know better, quite frankly, Kurt Angle, who, during his segment with Jeff and Karen, apparently made a comment where he threatened to kill both of them. He threatened to basically murder his ex-wife and her new husband. Yeah, I'd say that was a pretty bad comment to make. And again, I don't believe it. I mean, I watched the segment. I don't remember it airing during the show. So, you know, you could say that it makes an argument for scripting out promos like WWE does. I wouldn't go that far. I don't support the scripting of promos to the extent that WWE does it. I think you just have two veterans here, quite frankly, who should have known better, who said something pretty fucking stupid, and hopefully will not make the same mistake twice. I will say this in TNA's favor. This is probably the best compliment I can pay them this week, which really speaks volumes. The new TNA title belt, which might actually be the old TNA title belt, but it's the new belt they're using in place of Jeff Hardy's Divas Championship for their world title, looks much better than the Hardy Diva belt. And in fact, I think it looks much better than the WWE Championship belt, too. I am not a huge fan of that belt at all. I know it doesn't spin anymore, but it still sucks. And I actually think the TNA title looks better than the WWE title. So there, I said it. The D-Von Bully Ray feud has been iced. They have been probably having one of the best feuds going in TNA now the last couple of months. And Bully Ray has really evolved into one of the best heels in the entire company. And anybody who used to watch Bubba Ray when he would cut promos as heels in the old ECW, in terms of his verbiage, it was very, very dirty, but he was awesome at it. I mean, you will find no greater prick heel in the world than Bully Ray at his best. And he's been doing very well for himself in TNA. And apparently the payoff between him and D-Von was going to be in the form of a match at the upcoming Lockdown pay-per-view. And because of the situation with Jeff Hardy, Bully Ray has been slotted in to replace him. So already we see Jeff Hardy causing even more headaches for TNA, who again is planning at some point on bringing him back as a babyface. So, how does TNA repay its fans for a 90-second pay-per-view main event, you might be wondering to yourself? Why? You book an Impact show with almost no wrestling on it. I remember the Impact show that, and I don't remember when it was. I think it was sometime early, maybe it was a year ago. It was the Impact show that went, I think it was the same thing. It might have gone the first like 75 minutes of the show without a real wrestling match. You know, there might have been a throwaway Divas match or something, but they really didn't have any wrestling on the show for the first hour plus, and it pissed me off. But whatever, it pissed me off to a point because I don't watch Impact every single week. So, again, like I said, you're coming off a pay-per-view where there were a lot of very upset fans who paid for a real title match main event and got 90 seconds of bullshit. And on the first show you book after that show, you don't have any real wrestling matches in the first 75 minutes of the show. I'm not counting that 60-second knockouts match in hour number one either, by the way. That was not a real fucking match. So, yeah, that was pretty stupid. Now, you can compare that to 8 total matches on SmackDown this week, including a pretty good cage match between Christian and Alberto Del Rio that actually got over 10 minutes. And, again, it just supports my time. You know, they could still insert him in that match with Edge and make it a triple threat match at WrestleMania. You know, Christian's just too good not to have some sort of involvement at WrestleMania. So I'm hopeful that they will come to their senses and perhaps they'll still do that. But again, compare the two and there really is no comparison. I mean, granted, the matches on SmackDown didn't, you know, they weren't exactly Iron Man matches. But still, 8 wrestling matches on SmackDown, including a 10-minute plus main event. You get a 90-second pay-per-view main event in TNA, which is all their fault. And then you get 75 minutes of fucking bullshit before you get to your first match on the TV show. Then you had a 3-way match in the second hour for the now vacant TNA television title, which featured Gunner versus Murphy versus Rob Terry. Now, perhaps the people listening to this show who are bigger TNA fans than I can help me out here a little bit. I admit, I do not watch TNA Impact every week. That doesn't mean I don't know what goes on. Obviously, I follow the results and the spoilers, and I will check it out every now and then. But perhaps you can explain this to me. And by the way, I'm about to give a little bit of a spoiler here. So anybody that does not want to hear any TNA spoilers, skip ahead by about 5 minutes or so. That's your warning. So, on Impact this week, they have a three-way match for the vacant TV title. The TV title is vacant, apparently, because Abyss was murdered. Somebody attacked him. I think it was... I forgot who it was, but... regardless, Abyss was severely injured and therefore had to surrender the championship. And this was the match to determine a new TV champion. What happens on the next set of TNA Impact tapings for next week's show? Well, apparently Abyss makes his return. Which begs the question, why vacate the title in the first place? They did this exact same thing with Rob Van Dam last year. He got injured by Abyss, ironically. They had to strip him of the title. And he might have actually been back before the finals of their little tournament to determine a new champion had even taken place. Why vacate the title in the first place if the champion is ready to come back? It's one of those little things that just bugs the shit out of me. The only other good thing I could say about this show was I saw the AJ Styles injury angle at the end with Bully Ray, and I thought that was pretty good. The way they handled it and you know, making it sound... very serious, which it was. It was a hell of a bump that he took. And I will give them kudos on that. I thought the end was very well done by all involved. One other Impact note here, which again is a spoiler for a show that won't air for another week or two. So again, skip ahead if you don't want to hear it. Apparently on the tapings for the March 31st edition of Impact, Christopher Daniels makes his return, apparently as Christopher Daniels. Now, the problem with this is he is still under contract to Ring of Honor and is their TV champion. I think he had a match with, maybe it was Davey Richards, actually, at the ROH show yesterday. I have to go back and check. I don't believe his title was on the line. I could be wrong about that. So as far as I know, he's still the TV champion in ROH. Now, the two groups, ROH and TNA, they did reach an agreement a couple of weeks ago where Daniels could work TNA shows, provided that he wears a mask, which he's been doing as Suicide, and does not appear as Chris Daniels. So, if that's the case, and there's been no other agreement between the two of them for him to appear as anybody other than Christopher Daniels, or rather, to appear as Christopher Daniels, if that was forbidden, and he is under an ROH contract, here's yet another example of TNA potentially kicking themselves in the ass. Because unless they work something out with ROH already, this could be a very costly mistake for them. And in fact, I wonder if this will even air on TV. Apparently, it was a big angle on the show, too. So I don't see how you cannot air this on TV. So it's just, I don't even know what to say anymore. It's, you know, I've said before, I wish TNA would get rid of Russo or would just come to their senses. And it's just not going to happen. So I'm not even going to say it anymore. It's gotten to a point now where it's almost as though I feel like I should watch Impact every week and judge it not as a wrestling show, but as a comedy. So if I watch the show and judge it as a sitcom, I would probably give the show 4 stars every week. I'd probably enjoy it a lot more. And if they do any actual wrestling stuff that makes sense, or if they have a great wrestling match, I would give the show a negative rating. I feel like I should watch it for what it is. Could be entertaining. All right. A couple of other things here I want to get to in this packed podcast this week. I've got 4 different reviews of things here that I want to blow through here. And I want to start with Chris Jericho's book, Undisputed. I said last week I was not finished, but well into the book, and I was very much enjoying it. Now I've had a chance to finish the book, and it is an excellent book that I would highly recommend to anybody who has not read it or is on the fence about it or really doesn't read books all that much. You know, I'm not a big reader. I don't read all the time, which is not to say I can't read. I don't read books all that much. But I would give this 2 thumbs up and implore you to pay the money and buy the book or buy the ebook or whatever you do. But it's worth going out of your way to check out. What most fascinated me about this book was his... By his, I mean Jericho's relationship with Vince McMahon and all of the stories of the conversations that they've had over the years from when he first joined the WWF to all the different, you know, backstage drama and fights and when he left the company and came back to the company, just all the different things. It's almost like Vince McMahon is almost bipolar. When you read these stories, you know, in one story he can be this friendly, nice, compassionate guy, and then, you know, he could turn into a vicious monster for no good reason in a different situation. It's just fascinating stuff. And obviously there is an entire chapter in the book. It's the second to last chapter, dedicated to Chris Benoit. In fact, the title of the chapter is called simply Benoit. And I think Jericho has said in interviews that it was probably the hardest piece of writing he's ever had to do. And in fact, before he wrote the chapter on Chris Benoit, because it still pains him to just even think back to what happened, he actually got loaded on vodka, I think, before he wrote the chapter. And then at that point, he just let his emotions pour onto the page. It's just, it's a great piece of business. And it's still just depressing as all hell to go back and read it. But again, he was one of Benoit's best friends and knew his family, and Benoit knew his family. And just to listen to his thoughts on Benoit's behavior, especially after Eddie Guerrero died and Johnny Grunge died. Johnny Grunge, the former member of Public Enemy, was one of Benoit's best friends. They lived close to each other in Georgia. Their families were very friendly. And all of these deaths happened within a very short period of time. And it just, in Jericho's view, completely screwed up Benoit. It's not an excuse for what happened, but it's interesting to hear about all of these different things. And, you know, one thing in particular, when Jericho talks about being at the funeral of Eddie Guerrero in 2005, and Benoit, of course, was just absolutely beside himself with grief. Jericho, at that point, had already been out of the WWE for a couple of months. That was when he took his first sabbatical back in 05. And he, I think, probably the first time he had seen Benoit in person in a while. And Benoit came over and just hugged him and was just wildly weeping and crying on his shoulder. And then, I guess Benoit had maybe a black rose or something like that. And he, you know, Benoit was angry that Jericho had not been asked to be, I guess, a pallbearer at the funeral. And Benoit said, "Listen, you need to put this flower on his coffin. You have to do it. You're one of his good friends. You deserve to do it. You should take this and absolutely do it." And Jericho was going to do it. And then before Benoit walked off with the flower himself, and never even handed it to Jericho. It's just little things like that that Jericho thinks back to now and, you know, makes him think, God, there was something wrong with this guy. And, you know, maybe I should have said something. Maybe something could have been done, but it was not to be. And he talks also about his mother's death and reconnecting with the ex-boyfriend that turned her into a paraplegic. So there's just a lot of really good stuff in this book. And it's kind of funny because he ends the book almost exactly the same way he ended the first book. The end of Jericho's first book, it takes him literally right up until the moment that he's about to walk through the curtain for his WWF debut on Raw in 1999 with the countdown. And the way this book ends, let's just say that it ends in very similar fashion and leaves the door wide open for a third book in the Jericho trilogy. So two major thumbs up for this book. Definitely check it out if you have not already done so. And speaking of thumbs up, moving on to my second review here, The True Story of WrestleMania. I've not watched any of the matches from the DVD. I've just seen the documentary portion. And I don't really need to see the matches anyway. I've pretty much seen everything on there. But there was footage in this documentary I was very anxious to see because there was never before released footage in here. And I was very anxious to see it. And obviously that was my favorite part of the documentary, was the footage never before seen from the making of WrestleMania 9 in 1993. That was the Mania that took place outdoors from Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. Some people, and again, this is a WrestleMania that you either love it or you hate it. It was not a great show, but I have a soft spot in my heart for WrestleMania 9. I think just because it looked different. You know, there wasn't any match on that show that blew me away. There were no great matches on that show. I mean, the Steiner brothers and the Head Shrinkers had a pretty good tag match. Shawn Michaels and Tatanka had an intercontinental title match in the opener that was pretty good too, with a shitty finish. But there was nothing else about the show that was really all that great. And but this footage was fantastic. And there's footage in there of Vince McMahon talking to Shawn Michaels before the show. There's footage of Vince McMahon ushering Shawn Michaels through the curtain for his match before he walks out. There's Hulk Hogan in his street clothes before the show embracing the Giant Gonzalez, who's already in his skin suit. And the two of them are kind of, they're hugging and they're having a conversation backstage at Caesar's Palace. And there's one clip in there with Bret Hart, who's also, there's a couple of hours, I think, before the show. Bret is asking, where are all the girls at? Where's all the girls, he says. And if anybody has read Bret Hart's book, and I have not read Bret Hart's book, but my brother has. And so he would relay these stories to me about Bret and his infidelity, and his biggest vice on the road was sleeping around. And so it's kind of kind of ironic to see this particular clip here from 93 at WrestleMania of Bret. The only thing he seems to be concerned about is, where are the women at? So I thought that was kind of funny. Interesting that in reference to his match going on last at WrestleMania 18 after Rock Hogan, Triple H on the documentary said that him and Jericho both argued against the idea. But ultimately it was Vince McMahon's call that the title match should be the match to go on last. Now, what's interesting about this is that this clashes with rumors at the time that it was Triple H himself who argued that the title match should go on last because the title is too important not to go on last. So it all depends on who you believe. You either believe Triple H or you don't. I thought that was very interesting. Also interesting is that Hulk Hogan is really put over huge by everybody on the DVD, as he should be, because Hogan was a huge part of WrestleMania, the first 9 years, in fact, of WrestleMania. And you know what? Without a draw like Hogan at the top of the card, who's to say that WrestleMania would even be around today? Who's to say WrestleMania would be as big as it is? Hogan deserves his props for that, and I was very happy to see him get them on this DVD, which surprised me after his horrible ranking on that top 50 greatest stars of all time DVD, where they put him at like number 23 or something on the list, which again was a fucking joke. Say what you want to about Hulk Hogan and his, you know, being selfish and his wrestling ability or lack thereof. If you're making a list of the top 50 WWE stars of all time, Hulk Hogan cannot be number 23 on your list. He may not be number one, or he could be, but he should not be number 23. But on this DVD, he's put over like $1 million, and they have stock footage of him from, I guess, years ago when he was in the WWE, talking about how great WrestleMania is, how it's like the biggest show of all time, and again, kind of funny, given that he is in TNA now. And last but not least, this kind of bothered me a little bit. There's a clip on the DVD of Mean Gene Okerlund saying that WrestleMania 8 from the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis in 92 wasn't all that great of a show, which, in all honesty, it probably wasn't as good as it could have been. But again, WrestleMania 8 is, maybe it's a personal thing, but I love WrestleMania 8. It's one of those shows that from top to bottom is not great, but there's like at least two or three matches on that show that I look back fondly at. And yeah, there was that clusterfuck in the main event with Hogan and Sid, but I like WrestleMania 8 a lot, so it hurt me to see Mean Gene basically admitting that it wasn't all that great of a show and talking about how it should have been Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair in the main event. But Hogan vs. Flair had not done that well at the box office, at the house shows in the months before. I was surprised to hear them be very honest and upfront about that, because all of that is true. Although there's a little more to the story than just that. I mean, again, it was at the time Hogan was under a great deal of pressure. The steroid investigation was still ongoing, and Hogan basically just wanted to disappear for a while. And in fact, he disappeared for about a year. So that had more to do with it than anything else. But I thought this documentary overall was very good, because I figured it was just going to be the same old WrestleMania talk with the same interviews and the same clips from the same matches. And it was in many respects, but I think that never-before-seen footage and some of the interviews that we never saw before really freshened the story up a little bit. And again, is it all true and is it all honest from the heart? Of course not. There's a lot of bullshit here, but there's also a lot of stuff that they were pretty honest about, including the Hogan Flair stuff. So again, thumbs up if you have an opportunity to check it out. I have not seen the matches, but I think I've pretty much seen them all anyway. So watch the documentary if you can get a copy of it, because it is it'll be worth your while. All right, the Legends Roundtable with Bret the Hitman Hart is now up on the WWE Classics On Demand channel for those of you with a subscription. Jim Ross talked about this for the first time a couple of months ago. He said that he had been in Connecticut to tape two Legends Roundtable shows. The way this show works, it's a panel, and it's usually hosted by either Mean Gene Okerlund, as it is in this case, or Jim Ross. And sitting around them are four or five legends from the wrestling industry. And that entire show, which is usually about 80 minutes in length, is about one particular topic. It could be, you know, famous Canadian wrestlers. It could be greatest matches, worst wrestling feuds, whatever the subject matter is. And in this case, I believe it was greatest rivalries. And I was amazed by the footage that they included here of the Hulk Hogan Andre the Giant contract signing for their WrestleMania 3 match, which I realized afterwards, I went and I found it very easily on YouTube. I don't have any recollection of this segment at all. I don't remember seeing the entire thing. And I watched it, and in all honesty, it wasn't like it was, oh my God, it was so unbelievable, but it blew me away. It just blew me away. It doesn't answer the question about why Hulk Hogan was dressed in his gear while everybody else was wearing a suit and tie in the boardroom where the contract was being signed. Perhaps Hogan was... I really don't have any explanation for it, quite frankly, but Hogan was great. I mean, Hogan was selling this, you know, the intense look on his face, and I mean, he did a fantastic job, and even Andre just sitting there staring a hole in Hogan, and Andre was always a little bit difficult to understand because of the French accent, but he made some comments in the interview. Bobby Heenan, of course, was sitting next to Andre. He cut a promo on Hogan. He was fantastic as well, saying that, you know, in the contract we demand that when Andre beats Hogan, we don't want this crappy little title. This title belt was meant for a mere mortal. We want a new, bigger championship belt made for Andre's waist, which, in fact, they did make. And that big title belt appeared one time on TV and was never used again. And until many years later when Vince McMahon, I believe, presented the title to Planet Hollywood to go up on display. But it was a brief segment, but it blew me away because I just don't remember seeing it. So that's actually on the show. Hogan Andre is one of the greatest rivalries that's featured, although Bret Hart seems to disagree that it was a great rivalry. Bret seems to think, and I don't disagree with him on this, that the greatest feuds and rivalries in wrestling are based in some way, shape, or form on real-life tensions between the two parties involved. He would know better than anybody else about that, given the feud with him and Shawn Michaels, which is also featured on the show. But you know, I don't know that I would say Hogan-Andre wasn't a great feud. I mean, there's a reason that that match is still remembered, even though the match itself was fucking god-awful all these years later. But that's Bret's opinion. He's entitled to it. It focused also on Austin and The Rock, the Freebirds and the Von Erichs, and as I said, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. Now, a couple of things here. Bret, who is pretty good on this show, it starts. Bret is a very quiet guy. I don't know if it's the stroke or what, but he speaks very low key, and I was, you know, he didn't seem all that animated until the very end. Like at the very end, Bret seemed to really get going. He was getting more involved and speaking up and cracking jokes, and then the show ended, which was a little disappointing. But a couple of things with Bret. Bret takes credit for going to Vince McMahon and telling Vince to bring Steve Austin to the WWF. When, you know, the discussion is about Austin at one point during the show and all the superstardom that he went on to, and Bret takes credit for going to Vince while Steve was still in WCW and basically telling Vince, oh, you got to bring this guy over. I don't know if I'd buy that. I have no way to you know, debate Bret on this and say that he's wrong. I take him at his word, but I find that very hard to believe. And in the same show, Bret takes credit for telling people backstage that The Rock, when he was Rocky Maivia, was going to be the next big superstar and would take his place when Bret left wrestling. Again, perhaps he did say that. There were a lot of people, more than just Bret Hart at the time, who said The Rock was going to be the next big thing. Perhaps Bret was one of those people, but the fact that Bret Hart would take credit for basically, you know, predicting the success that Austin and Rock would each have, I find that a little difficult to believe, but whatever. Bret also said something else here that I don't completely buy. In reference to Montreal, you knew Montreal would come up, and it did. And Michael Hayes was really pressing Bret Hart on this and asking him questions. And in reference to it, Bret said that if Vince McMahon would have come to him and said, listen, we're going to screw you tonight, and then we're going to bring you back in 3 years when your WCW contract expires, and we'll do it as part of an angle, Brett basically said that if this would have been the way that it went down, if Vince would have presented this to him as an idea, he would have done it. And I call bullshit on that. I love Bret Hart, but I call bullshit on that. I don't buy that for a second. And in fact, I think Bret's done interviews, and he's done thousands of interviews about this over the years. I'm not going to go back and find which one it was, but I'm almost positive I've heard him answer questions about this before, and he gave a completely different answer, that he never would have agreed to something like that, which I tend to believe. No. Who in their right mind would agree to something like that? Oh, yeah, I'm going to let you screw me over tonight and make me look like a joke and take the title away from me, even though I've been fighting you over the last month about this tooth and nail. I'm going to let you do that, and then I'm going to go serve my 3 years in WCW. And then in 36 months, I'm going to come right back to the WWF, and we're going to make a big angle out of it. 3 years after the fact. I don't buy that for a second. So, Bret Hart was suffering, in my opinion, from a little bit of Hulk Hogan syndrome on the Legends Roundtable. But it's an entertaining show, so if you could track down a copy, I don't think it's anywhere on YouTube. You probably have to subscribe to it if you have it available in your area. Otherwise, I don't really know what to tell you. But if you can watch it, it's definitely worth checking out. The next Legends Roundtable is going to be about, I believe, Canadian wrestlers or Canadian something or other. And so, of course, Brett, I think, is on the panel for the next show as well, and I assume that won't air for another 2 or 3 months, so I'll keep everybody posted on that. And last but not least here, I got another little bonus review for you here on this bloated edition of the Sound Off on something that I can guarantee 95% or more of the people listening have not seen. So I figured let me talk about it here. There's a little movie out. I know I mentioned this a couple of months back on the Sound Off when I first heard that this movie was coming out. I didn't know when it was coming out, but I knew it was going to be straight to DVD. And it's an independent film, I guess a horror movie, I guess if you can call it that, called River of Darkness. This is the movie that stars Kurt Angle, Kevin Nash, and as he is billed in the movie, okay, this is how he is billed in the credits, Psycho Sid Vicious. So, I have been waiting with bated breath for this movie to come out. I didn't know if it was going to be in theaters, if it was in fact going to be straight to DVD, if it was not going to come out at all, because it was so awful. And then I was stunned to find out that the movie was in fact already out. It came out last year, on DVD, I guess. So, I tracked down a copy of this movie. Couldn't wait to watch it. I watched it in a couple of installments this week. I didn't watch it in one sitting. And the basic story of the movie is this. There is a string of murders in a small town for which Kurt Angle is the sheriff, which is funny in and of itself. So you have Sheriff Angle, and people are being knocked off, brutally massacred, and they're being massacred by the Jacobs Boys. Now, the Jacobs Boys themselves are dead. The Jacobs Boys are, in fact, Kevin Nash, Sid Vicious, and another guy who nobody really focuses on because, well, he's not Kevin Nash or Sid Vicious. But there are technically three Jacobs Boys. And legend has it that one of the locals in town murdered them or whatever happened, he basically killed or did something that resulted in the killing of the Jacobs Boys. And the legend has it that they were in purgatory. And, you know what they say, after 30 years of purgatory, you're either going to come back for revenge or you're going to go to heaven. And I guess in this case, the Jacobs Boys served their 30 years and they were back for revenge. And Kurt Angle does not believe any of this. And he's not called Kurt Angle in the movie, but he doesn't buy any of this. He's on the case. He's trying to figure out what the fuck is going on around here. And then I realized there's another wrestler in this movie, which I was completely unaware of. And in fact, I saw him in one of the first scenes he appeared in, and I didn't even realize it until the second scene he was in. But Ray Lloyd is in this movie. Now, for those of you who don't know who Ray Lloyd is, Ray Lloyd was the man who played Glacier in WCW for a brief time back in the late 90s. Before he had these vignettes that played for him for weeks. He was basically a carbon copy of the Sub-Zero character from Mortal Kombat, only he didn't have the hood. But I think that's basically where they got the idea for his character from. and he had cool music, and of course, after a couple of weeks, he was basically just another mid-card nobody that nobody cared about. So, Glacier is in this movie, and I guess as the story goes, he was in competition with Kurt Angle's character to become the sheriff of the town, but Kurt won, and so this guy now runs his own restaurant, and it's not that there's animosity between the two of them, but, you know, basically, the scenes that Glacier is in this movie, it's scenes to the effect of him talking to Kurt Angle and trying to find out, what are you doing? What are you doing to solve this? Are you going to do anything? Or are you just going to keep twiddling your thumbs? And I will say this, of all the actors, of the wrestlers in this movie, Glacier is actually the best one out of all of them. And it's not so much me saying that Glacier is a great actor, it's more of an indictment on the acting skills of the people in this movie. Kevin Nash does not have a very large speaking role. In fact, he has about one line in the entire movie where he gets shot by Kurt Angle's character. And, of course, he's dead already, so you can shoot him all you want to. It's not going to do anything. And I think Nash mutters, like, I'm already dead. And that's about the only line he has in the whole movie besides some grunting and groaning. Sid Vicious doesn't have any fucking lines in the movie. He just has he does those what I call Sid facials, where he'll gaze into the camera with his big bug eyes and make these faces. Him and Nash have this makeup on that make them look like dead rotting corpses. Just for the record. And that's basically the story of the entire movie. And it's bad acting. It's, you know, an independent horror film. It's exactly what you would expect. If you came into this expecting a great film, then I don't know what to say about that. I knew exactly what to expect going into it. So it was a bad movie. And then came the ending. And I don't think I'm giving anything away here, so I'll go ahead and spoil it. The end of the movie basically comes when Glacier's character in the movie rounds up one or two of his friends in town. They've decided that Kurt Angle ain't doing shit. So people are getting killed. A little girl got killed now. Enough with the killings. They're going to take matters into their own hands. The Jacobs boys clearly are after this one guy who lives in town that, again, they hold responsible for their deaths 30 years earlier. So they figure, we're going to find this guy whose name is Hicks, and they're gonna kidnap him, and they're going to go to the river where the Jacobs boys have been stalking their victims and put him in a little boat, and they're going to float him to the part of the river where the Jacobs boys drowned 30 years earlier. And hopefully the Jacobs boys will come out from wherever they are, and they'll accept this guy as a sacrifice, and they'll leave everybody else alone. Kurt Angle gets wind of this, and the big climax of the movie is on the river. Kurt Angle catches them in the act. He tells them, don't do that. Don't push the boat over to where the Jacobs boys are, because now, off in the shadows, there are the Jacobs boys. And Glacier basically, well, he doesn't say this, but he basically says, fuck you. And he tells the two friends, push the boat out. And the poor son of a bitch is tied up, sitting on a little boat, and the boat is being pushed out towards the Jacobs boys. And the other thing I forgot to mention here is that in the midst of all this, there are three young people, because you have to have young people in a movie like this who keep getting knocked off. Two of them are killed during the course of the movie. They're basically paranormal researchers, although there's no explanation for why they're actually here or what they're researching. So it's two guys and a girl. Sounds dirty. The two guys get killed. The girl, of course, is still alive. She has survived to this point. And she had been stranded on a boat in the middle of the river before Kurt Angle rescued her in the scene prior. So she is on the boat that Kurt Angle is on, although she is she's nowhere to be seen in this particular scene until, as the man in the boat, Hicks, is being rowed toward the Jacobs boys, before they have a chance to bludgeon this poor bastard to death, we see that the guy is shot through the eye, almost like a mercy killing. And the Jacobs boys proceed to hack him up into a million different pieces anyway. But we have no idea who fired the shot from the gun. And then we pan back to see that it was in fact the girl, the so-called paranormal researcher, who took one of Kurt Angle's, I guess, rifles and blew a hole right through the guy's eyeball. Again, presumably as a mercy killing. And as they pan up to this girl, everybody's looking at her, and she lowers the gun and says, "That's my grandfather." So we are all led to believe that she was doing her grandfather a favor instead of saving him, she basically blew his brains out before he could, I guess be hacked up into a million pieces, which he was anyway. So I thought to myself, that's the way the movie ends. I mean, I know that the Kevin Nash character and the Sid character are already dead, but still, if you're watching Friday the 13th with Jason Voorhees, you don't just give up and say, oh, well, this guy can't be killed anyway, so just leave him alone. No, you try to kill him anyway, or at least contain him in some way. But nope, they let the Jacobs boys hack this guy up into a million pieces, and the next scene is, it's a different day. It's the daylight. And I was angered at this point. I said, I just dedicated almost 90 minutes of my life to watching this movie, and this is how it ends? And basically, the way the movie started, I should go back and say, the movie started with this girl that I talked about, the girl that blew the guy's brains out. It was one of these movies that starts out in the present day, and then we go back in time to see the story. Well, now the story is over, and we're back in the present day. So we're back to the girl who is, she's outdoors in some snowy location, sitting on a bench, and we hear her doing the narration. And she basically explains in the narration that the only reason I didn't go to jail was because they said what I did was a mercy killing. And again, at this point, I'm sitting here still angry, thinking to myself, what a fucking shitty ending to this movie. And again, she says, well, the only reason I didn't get arrested was because it was a mercy killing. And then there's a pause. And then she looks up at the camera and smirks. And she says, mercy killing my ass. I shot the man who raped my mother. And then the movie goes to credits. And at that point, I thought to myself, you know what? Okay, that redeemed it a little bit for me at the end. That was an interesting little twist, I will admit, that I did not see coming. So I will give the movie its due. It was a terrible movie, and the ending really pissed me off up until that part. And when she said that, I thought to myself, bravo. Bravo. That's quite a way to redeem yourself there. That actually made me think, okay, this is not such a horrible ending after all. So, I know I'm not a professional movie reviewer there, so I apologize for jumping around, but that's my River of Darkness review. By no means do I think if you actually find a DVD copy, should you spend one red cent on this. But if you can somehow obtain a copy of it, by whatever means, it's an interesting way to kill 90 minutes of your time, and knowing that, even though I just spoiled the whole fucking thing for you, I thought the payoff at the very, very end actually kind of redeemed it for me. And if nothing else, it's kind of entertaining to see Diesel and Psycho Sid together as the undead, chopping people into bits and putting spikes through people's eyeballs and stuff like that, and watching Kurt Angle and Glacier argue back and forth with each other is actually kind of surreal. So, that's my River of Darkness review. Alright, so let's get to the a quick version of the mailbag here. Apologize in advance. I have a ton of questions here, and I will try to respond to certain people directly. The questions I don't get to, hopefully I'll get to on next week's show. I knew I wasn't going to have enough time this week for a full mailbag here, so I have a couple of questions, though, that I will get to. First things first, one of our listeners here, Shayabur Rahman, wrote in to let me know that today, Sunday, is his mother's birthday. And he thought to himself, what could be a better gift than getting her a shout-out by the Sala Monster? Would appreciate it a lot. Thanks, and as usual, keep up the great work. So I wanted to give his mom a shout-out here on the podcast. And if you think that's the best gift that you can get her, is a sound-off from me on this show, well, I think you're going to be in a lot of trouble, but there you go. Happy birthday, Miss Rahman. Hope you're listening. David writes in, says, Dear Sala Monster, you mentioned the infamous WCW title match on Raw back in 2001 that officially killed the company. Obviously, the match didn't affect Booker T. Unfortunately, Buff Bagwell was never seen again. I wonder how he felt when he discovered that his match destroyed the slim chance of WCW surviving for a few more years. I don't recall Bagwell, and maybe he has, doing any interviews where he talked about how he felt about the fact that perhaps he is responsible for the final nail in the coffin of the WCW brand. But I will go out on a limb here and say that he probably either A, doesn't care, or B, more likely, he probably doesn't think he had that bad of a match. So my guess is he would probably refuse to accept the idea that he was in any way responsible for the death of WCW. That would be my guess, knowing what I know about Buff Bagwell. Chestnut writes in, one of my loyal listeners, maybe a touchy subject, but how far do you think Chris Benoit could have gone, providing that everything that happened in 2007, in fact, did not happen? I think Chris Benoit went pretty damn far before he went off the deep end. I don't know exactly what the question is here. You know, I mean, Benoit, before he did what he did, was revered as one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. He main evented WrestleMania 20 at Madison Square Garden. He became the World Heavyweight Champion. He was an Intercontinental Champion. He was a Tag Team Champion. He probably would have been the ECW Champion on that night had he not killed himself. I think Benoit went pretty far in the business. I don't really know how much farther he could have gone other than, you know, becoming a trainer and passing his knowledge on to some of the younger guys and eventually going into the Hall of Fame, which I know for a fact he would have ended up in the Hall of Fame had all of that not happened. I suppose that's as far as he would have gone, but beyond that, I think he did pretty good for himself in the time that he did spend in the wrestling business. I don't really think he had too many more milestones to attain. Grant writes into the podcast. He has apparently an explanation for the pearl necklace reference that John Cena had in his promo on Raw 2 weeks ago that I ranted about last week. He says it's, let's see here, in emailing you about the pearl necklace gimmick, wanted to let you know the reason Cena used that as a reference was because of the whole Fruity Pebble and Yabba Dabba thing. These two things are related to the cartoon show The Flintstones, which I already knew. Yabba Dabba was used by Fred Flintstone in the cartoon, which, again, I knew. In the cartoon, Fred gives his wife a pearl necklace. This is how the gimmick fits into his rap. This could have meant calling The Rock a girl or a stay-at-home wife, given that The Rock stayed home while giving his promo. So that's Grant's explanation. I guess that makes sense. I still think Cena meant it in a different way. But I could see creatively where that would be kind of a clever way to work that reference in there. I did not realize that, so it's an interesting point. He also wants to know, what did I think of the shirt Cena made for The Rock that says, "I bring it via satellite"? I thought it was great. Again, you know, Cena didn't make the shirt himself. You know, WWE gave it to him. I'm not even sure it was Cena's idea. But and I might have mentioned that. I thought the shirt itself was actually pretty damn hilarious. It was one of the only funny things about that entire promo. All right, let's see here. Rude Boy writes in, "Dear Solomonster, absolutely love the show. For me, it's Monday Raw, Friday SmackDown, Sunday Sound Off. I have two questions stemming from your comments on The Miz last week, having the worst-looking finisher, even though I don't agree with you the first time I disagree with you. First, besides The Worm, what is the worst finisher, in your opinion, of all time?" I would have to say the Yeti, the giant mummy. It didn't last very long, but he did appear in WCW at least once, I think more than once, and I don't know if he ever had an official match, but I know when he first made his appearance, and it was, I think, Halloween Havoc in 95, and him and the Giant worked in tandem to basically dry hump Hulk Hogan, and I presume that the Yeti's finishing move is, or was, or would have been some sort of bear hug, but it didn't look like a bear hug at all. It looked like something that I wish not to speak of. Easily one of the worst-looking maneuvers that I've ever seen. Second question, who had the best super kick? Shawn Michaels, with all of his theatrics and stomping of the feet and everything, or Lance Storm? I know HBK has beaten more people with it, but which one looked more kick-ass? Believe it or not, I'm going to say Lance Storm's kick looked more kick-ass than Shawn Michaels. Now, don't get me wrong, Shawn Michaels has had, especially in the last couple of years, he's had some pretty sick-looking super kicks. Obviously, the Shelton Benjamin one. But even, like, normal, regular super kicks, some of the ones that he has delivered in recent years in some of his matches have been pretty brutal. But Lance Storm, more consistently in his matches, even though he wasn't as big of a star as Shawn Michaels, and didn't beat as many people with the move, you know, the way he connected with it and the sound that it made just made it look more brutal. So I'm actually going to go, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Lance Storm actually had the sicker-looking super kick. That would have been a match, by the way, that I would have loved to have seen. Shawn Michaels against Lance Storm would have been one hell of a wrestling match. Eddie from San Jose, California. He's been a listener since episode 119. His question is, why did WCW have Hulk Hogan dropped the WCW Championship to Lex Luger on Nitro in August, that would have been, of 1997, and then make him lose it that Sunday at the Hog Wild pay-per-view. What was the point of that? Thanks for your great show. I am addicted to it. As I remember, I've never heard any explanation other than this. It was purely a ratings grab. They were hoping to drum up interest in the pay-per-view. They wanted to pop a big rating on Nitro, which I believe they did. And, in fact, Hogan did win the belt right back from Luger on the pay-per-view. And looking back, it was really stupid because, obviously, it was stupid if they were just going to put the belt back on Luger so quickly. Or back on Hogan, rather. But, you know, when Hogan joined the NWO, he won the WCW Championship in August of 1996 at the Road Wild pay-per-view beating the Giant. And I'm fairly certain Hogan did not lose that title at all until he dropped it to Luger on Nitro. Now, again, they were building up the Hogan-Sting feud with every expectation that Sting would finally face Hogan in a match at the end of 1997 and at the Starrcade pay-per-view. And they would do big business, and that would be the pay-per-view after a year plus when Hogan would finally drop the belt and WCW would win the war, or at least win a battle over the NWO because they were getting their ass kicked every week. And I look back on that now, and it's even dumber in hindsight because Hogan was champion, again, I'm pretty sure, for a year straight. And Sting ended up beating him for the belt anyway in a couple of months, but you know, you had Hogan with the title for a year. You're building Sting up as your primary challenger. The people are just dying to see Hogan get his and for somebody to take the title from the NWO. And Sting is going to be that guy. And instead, on live television for free on Nitro, you have Hulk Hogan give up clean as a sheet. He submits in the torture rack, and Lex Luger wins the championship. And then they have this big celebration in the ring. Looking back, I can't believe they did that. And they did the exact same thing 3 or 4 months later with Sting. I don't understand it. It was for ratings, I guess, and they were hoping maybe it would result in more business for their pay-per-view. I don't think it did. And Road Wild was consistently just one of the worst pay-per-views WCW had. I mean, you talk about an awful environment. I mean, in some respects, there was something cool, I guess, about a wrestling ring in the middle of like 250,000 bikers on motorcycles. But you have no gate, so there's no ticket charges, ticket prices. Everybody comes in for free, so you're not making any money on the pay-per-view in that respect. In fact, you're probably losing money for the cost of hosting the pay-per-view and the production and everything. And on top of all that, you have all these motorcycle people who were honking their horns and revving their engines, and you could barely hear what's going on. And, of course, Eric Bischoff was and still is a big motorcycle buff, and he would do the ride down to Sturgis for the big rallies down there, which is why they had the pay-per-views there. So I guess it was more of a vanity thing for Eric Bischoff, but it's something different. I'll never criticize somebody for trying something different at least once, but they did it more than once, and it was not a good atmosphere for a wrestling show. So that's why they did it. And looking back, it's even dumber now than it was back then. All right, and lastly here, Gilbert from Fresno, California, writes into the podcast, digs the show, and has two questions here. Number one, what's the beef with the New Age Outlaws and Shawn Michaels and Triple H? I heard part of an interview where the Outlaws talk shit about Michaels and Triple H. And the second question, speaking of the Outlaws, what did you think of Billy Gunn teaming up with Chuck Palumbo? Did you think the Billy and Chuck team were a good one? Well, the first question, I'm assuming he didn't specify what interview he watched. The Outlaws did a sit-down shoot interview several years ago. Might have been with RF Video. I don't recall. But I watched the interview, and they did talk shit about Shawn, and more so Triple H, if I recall. Billy Gunn especially. They were really ragging on them. And at the time, they had, they were a bit bitter, I guess, over the way they were treated, perhaps the way they were fired or left the WWF. And they were harboring a lot of ill will. And I don't think they would probably say the same things today that they did back then. They were obviously still very upset, so that's why they talk trash. So, for example, the Road Dogg is going to be back in the WWE at the Hall of Fame. He's one of the people inducting his father, Bullet Bob. And so, obviously, Triple H will be there. Shawn Michaels is going into the Hall of Fame. I'm sure that if Road Dogg finds them or bumps into them, they will exchange pleasantries and all will be well. I don't think there's going to be an all-out brawl at the Hall of Fame. So, to me, it's just two guys who were bitter and upset about something that must have happened, and they did this shoot interview, and they probably said some shit that they regret saying. And as for the Billy and Chuck team, at the time, they didn't really do much for me. And, you know, again, looking back, it was actually a pretty good gimmick. You know, the payoff was that big wedding they had on SmackDown where Billy and Chuck were going to get married. They were hoping to get some publicity out of it. You know, the first ever, gay wedding on WWE television. And I think, if anything, it probably outraged more people who felt they were exploiting the issue more than anything else. I know, WWE exploiting an issue, that would never happen. And the payoff to the angle was not that Billy and Chuck were actually homosexuals. But, you know, they blame Rico, who was, you know, Rico Constantino, who was their manager at the time, because they were bamboozled. They thought, you know, Rico said that this would get them more notoriety and would get them a push, basically. That was their argument. And Rico betrayed them. And then, of course, the 3-minute warning, Jamal and Rosie came out and cleaned house, and Eric Bischoff was there. That was actually a really, really, really well-done angle. And I didn't even recognize Bischoff, who was under the prosthetics. He was the priest for the ceremony, and it was really well done. If you find that on YouTube, watch that whole segment because it was really, really good. And I think the payoff didn't get the attention that it should have gotten. But looking back on it, you know what? They were actually a pretty good team, and they really got into their gimmick, and you got to respect them for that. A lot of guys probably would have shied away from that. They would have been pissed off. For all I know, it could have been their own idea, but I thought they did really well with it. So, and it got them a lot of TV time. They were tag team champions. I think they were even tag team champions through WrestleMania 18. So, you know, not a bad gig if you can get it. So that's going to be it for the mailbag. Going to wrap this thing up here. This is officially the single longest sound off I've ever recorded. And there was a lot going on this week. And then I had my reviews that I wanted to get in there. So just a jam-packed show this week of just different news and things going on, good things and bad things alike. And if you have questions, keep sending them on in. I didn't get to all of them this week. I do hope to get to most, if not all, of your questions at some point, maybe on the next show. So email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com, all one word. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/solemonster. We're almost at 760 followers and growing. And find me on Facebook and friend me there, facebook.com/thesolemonster. I update people throughout the week on both Facebook and Twitter, sometimes more so on one than the other. So you should get on both. They're free. They don't cost you anything. And if you're not a Twitter person, I guarantee that once you're on Twitter, you will become a Twitter person. So I am an enabler now, I know, but get on there if you're not already on there. By the way, I found those clips from, again, the shows that I had done for a friend. My friend had a radio show. It wasn't a wrestling radio show, but it was a radio show on his local radio station. This was back in 2002, and he asked that I would call in and talk about wrestling, do like a wrestling segment. I found this stuff recently. It was fascinating to go back and listen to, especially given what was going on in wrestling back at the time. And I got enough emails from people who were kind of curious to listen to it where I'm not going to upload these things as their own standalone segments. But what I think I'll do is I'll edit them down. I'll edit some of the clips out of them of me talking about different stories that were going on at the time in WWE. And maybe I'll splice them into the next sound off. So if that sounds cool, maybe I'll try doing that. So those of you who were kind of curious to hear those clips, stay tuned. I'll try to get them into the next show, episode 152. So that's going to do it for this week. A lot of good stuff, a lot of bad stuff. WWE, ashamed to call themselves a wrestling organization, even though that's exactly what they are. TNA, not giving a fuck about its fans, screwing them over and spitting in their face. Again, I don't blame Jeff Hardy for that situation at all. I blame TNA. And hopefully both of these companies can get their heads out of their asses and get back to doing what they do best. And we'll be back here next week with a new show, hopefully more pleasant stuff to talk about. So until then, be well, stay safe, keep spreading the good word of the sound off. Without you guys, there is no show. I appreciate it. See you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemn Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.